We don't usually typically testify before your committee, as we have the Early Childhood Committee, but we felt it was important for us to testify today to let you know that the proposed cuts by the governor, particularly the 5% provider rate, may lead a lot of people that have left the MFIP program to return. The 5% cut in provider rates will substantially erode the integrity of the child care assistance program, will harm many businesses, will lead to job losses, and will disrupt thousands of Minnesota families with young children and small business owners around the state. A 2003 and another 2005 studies on economic impact of the child care industry in Minnesota had three key points. It has a current and immediate impact on the economy by supporting working parents so they may stay employed. It has long-term impact on the economy by providing quality programs that prepare children for school and reducing costs for a range of social issues in the future. And child care itself, it's a major contributor to the economy. It's composed of over 11,000 small businesses, providing jobs for over 36,000 Minnesotans, and generating $1.5 billion per year to the state economy, providing care to 360,000 children. Our child care system is required by federal legislation to give families using child care assistance equal access to different types of care. As of 2009, 32% of centers and 40% of family care providers are technically within reach of the child care assistance families, unless families on the program can pay the difference. As a result of the 2003 cuts, we have seen a net loss of 1,600 licensed child care providers in Minnesota, resulting in thousands of job loss, disruption of thousands of families. Every closing has multiple job losses, small business losses. More importantly, the continuum of providing training, the loss of stability for the family, and the interruption of the close relationships that have been built between children and adults. If the governor's recommendations to cut 5% of rates passes, providers will be forced to choose between passing an additional cost to parents or accepting the decreased rate, threatening the financial health of their small businesses. Passing on the cost to parents makes child care out of reach for many families, for whom cost of care is disproportionately high compared to their incomes. The lowest income families count on child care assistance to make work and child care a possibility. These increases will force them to choose between staying in the workforce or settling for care that is less safe and consistent, or leaving the workforce entirely. Based on previous experiences with cuts, many families will choose the latter, rejoining MFIP and other government programs. In addition, many providers who primarily care for children from low to moderate income families will choose simply to stop doing so or closing their doors. Many providers with CCAP children will not have the access to the resources to cover the difference. To conclude, are concerned that the cuts to the child care assistance program, particularly the proposed reduction in provider rates, will erode the integrity of the CCAP program, will force some people to choose between work and unreliable or possibly unsafe care for kids, or leaving the workforce entirely and returning to MFIP, and will reduce the ability of many of the parents with young children to work, will cause disruptions for thousands of Minnesotans who should most support in these difficult times. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Charles? Representative Liebling.
Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you very much for being here. And it's more of a comment, but I guess a question, too. I mean, last election cycle, I was out door knocking and, you know, met a woman who just told me, you know, she just was so thankful for this program and wasn't using it anymore, but told me how it had really helped her get going, and she's a single mother and now she doesn't need it and she's got a good job. And you know, I mean, I am so committed to this program. I know we all are. We all really understand how important it is, and I really appreciate your comments. I guess I want to ask you, you know, given the reality of what we're facing, if we had to cut the program in some way, is there any way that we can, what adjustment could we make? Is there anything we can do that you think would be less harmful? I'm not saying there's anything that, you know, we should be adding money to this program, not cutting money from the program, definitely. But
that will be my
you know,
Mr.
but is there, Is there a way we can do it to cause less harm than other ways it might happen?
Chair, Representative Liebling, the program has been cut so severely since 2003 that any small cut, it's actually devastating for these families, because of not only for the providers but for the families they're serving. I really don't have a good answer for you there. Hopefully between now and the end of session, we may be able to have an answer for you. But at this point, in the course of things, it's best to advocate for actually more resources, not less. But I know that the economic times forbid us from doing so.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And thanks for the comments.
Yeah, and this actually will go through Representative Slawick's committee. She will have to meet her target, and then that eventually it will be incorporated into our bill.
Correct. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you. Dr. David Gesko. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for welcoming me. I'm Dr. David Gesko, Dental Director and Senior Vice President for Health Partners Dental Group and Clinics, as well as the Health Partners Dental Plan. We are arguably one of the largest providers in Minnesota of dental care to public program enrollees, and as such, the governor's supplemental budget recommendation is of great concern to us. In 2009, we served nearly 19,000 distinct state public programs patients at our 16 dental sites. We provide much of that care at our Midway Dental Center, not far from here, a specially designed dental practice just off of University, and where we serve public programs patients with added services and features to address their unique needs. We built Midway especially to serve this population and have focused its operation on the effective dental treatment to a diverse population. Midway's population is nearly 100% public programs and is positioned in a geographic location to best meet those needs. If Health Partners is cut off from access to critical access funding, this population is positioned to lose access to much-needed dental care services. You see, given the realities of the cost to provide excellent care, critical access is a much-needed piece of the puzzle in order to allow providers such as us to just minimally cover our costs. As the director of Health Partners Dental Group, I keenly understand the need to balance a budget and that everyone must make sacrifices. However, as a healthcare professional, my foremost concern is to the well-being of my patients. Oral health problems cause physical suffering, premature death, disrupt children's education, reduce business productivity, and entail considerable expense to treat advanced diseases. Additionally, if access is disrupted to this population, care will be sought at costly emergency departments where the cost-benefit equation is completely lost. During the last legislative session, we were able to strike a balance that produced a well-crafted reform to our dental public programs. I personally sat down with a number of stakeholders, including the Minnesota Dental Association, other safety net dental providers, and legislators, to hammer out a reform proposal that reduced public programs' dental spending by some $18 million, or approximately 20%. This included innovative concepts such as piloting dental urgent care clinics in emergency rooms and establishing a dental subcommittee under the auspices of DHS to advise the commissioner on how to best target critical access funding. We designed an adult dental benefit for state public programs that balanced the need to reduce spending with the desire to produce and provide minimally necessary treatment that would reduce the likelihood of costly emergency room use for acute dental needs. It also included cuts to the bottom lines of safety net providers through the line item veto of GAMC and the 5% cut to specialty providers, including dentists. Then the governor chose to unallot as a budget solution, and among those additional cuts was a temporary suspension of the Medicaid portion of the critical access dollars. Critical access dental provider payments enable safety net providers to keep their doors open and to treat people on public programs in a much more appropriate clinical setting. It is key to sustaining access for the most vulnerable. This $6.2 million unallotment struck hard to these critical access dental providers. Now, in the governor's budget proposal, the Medicaid portion of critical access dollars would be eliminated entirely. And the amount available for MinCare would be significantly reduced. The mechanism for reducing these dollars is to reduce the number of dentists who qualify for the payment. Under the governor's proposal, only certain safety net providers, community clinics that meet specific criteria, federally qualified health centers, and a few others, would be eligible to receive critical access payments. These criteria would eliminate Health Partners Dental Group from receiving any dollars. As the largest critical access provider in the state, this is a serious blow, not only financially, but for our operations as a partnership with the Department of Human Services. Our Midway Dental Center was specifically designed, as I said, with this population in mind. State public programs already reimburse dentists at far less than their fixed costs. Seeing public programs patients is a financially troubling prospect for any dental practice. Yet our mission is to improve the health of our members, our patients, and our community. And as such, we are committed to serving this population. Critical access dollars makes that tenable. Under the scenario laid out in the governor's budget, we face a decision that could significantly affect access in the metro area. Without critical access dollars that we have been using to support the losses at the Midway Clinic, we are concerned about our ability to keep it open. We are already hearing of problems in the community for state public programs patients to find dental care. Payment cuts and high needs are causing some providers to turn away from this population. Reducing critical access payments exacerbates that problem. So in conclusion, I strongly encourage you to reject the governor's proposal on critical access dollars and to restore the program to its former level. Specifically, Health Partners must not be excluded from the access to this much-needed funds in order to keep our head above water. It is critical to the ability of state public programs enrollees to access care. Thank you for your attention to my message. I also want to, I'm sorry she's not here today, but Representative Bunn, I want to thank her for going over the top in terms of helping us being a large group of stakeholders, address the dental needs of Minnesota, and she has been an invaluable help to our cause and to the Minnesotans that rely on this care. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, Mr. Freeman.
Good morning, Chairman Huntley, members of the committee. My name is Robert Freeman. I represent Health Partners and Regents Hospital. I thank you for the opportunity to testify on the impact of the governor's budget recommendations on Regents Hospital. In addition to providing award-winning care, Regents serves as the safety net hospital in the East Metro. Approximately 55% of our revenue comes from government programs, and we provide a disproportionate share, additionally, of charity care. In 2009, Regions alone provided about $18 million in uncompensated care to over 28,000 patients who came from 85 out of 87 Minnesota counties, western Wisconsin, and other surrounding states. We provide extensive educational programs for future doctors, nurses, allied health professionals. Our services, including trauma, adult and pediatric, burn, wound, and psychiatric services, provide critical care not only to the East Metro, but to the entire state and upper Midwest. Once again, the governor's budget proposal disproportionately targets Minnesota hospitals, specifically safety net hospitals, to solve the state's budget deficit. While these cuts are targeted at a few, the impact will be felt by our entire community. We estimate that the recommendations to cut inpatient hospital rates, lower medical education spending, decreasing Minnesota care eligibility, and reducing mental health support and services would have a $6 million negative impact on regions during the upcoming biennium. This is in addition to the $13 million cut during the last legislative session and the estimated $23 million that will be lost if GAMC is eliminated. Frankly, these cuts are too much to ask one hospital to absorb. We're finalizing our contingency planning and everything is on the table. In response to past cuts, we've terminated employment, frozen salaries, cut back capital expenditure such as our desperately needed behavioral building. We are now looking at cutting back on services including mental health and our outpatient cancer treatment center. That means all patients, not just the poor, will be impacted. As we make these decisions, we are committed to ensuring that reductions don't impact care at the bedside and the safety of our workforce. However, cuts of these magnitude are unsustainable over time, and they will force us to reevaluate who we are, provider for the poor, trainer of our future doctors, and caretaker for our children. We know the current budget shortfall means that we all need to be part of the solution. We're doing our part. But we're very concerned by the inequity of the cuts. Regions has answered the call to become more accountable for healthcare access, quality, and cost. Programs such as our Mental Health Drug Assistance Program have not only provided needed prescriptions to patients, but have also lowered emergency room and public safety costs. Respectfully request that you consider this as you deliberate the governor's budget proposal and the continued need for a GAMC solution. Furthermore, I urge you to help those in need by protecting Minnesota's safety net for more devastating cuts. I thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions? Representative Giffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question I actually have has more to pertain to Dr. Gesko at this time, but I think it affects both of you, Mr. Freeman, as well. And one of the comments that you made that I've read through the language, too, that I have a concern about is the fact that the critical access dollars would go to a select group and disallow it from others. And so I have a concern about that as well. And so do you have suggestions for how to handle it otherwise? Just take the same reduction, but instead of selecting only a group that can get it, that it is able to be spread out amongst everybody who provides this service?
Well, Dr. Gesko.
Excellent timing, Representative Bunn. Representative Bunn, as I said in my testimony, has worked with that group of people to look at the critical access funding, and I believe has proposed amendments that would allow the critical access dollars to continue and to be spread over a larger number of individual practices, ensuring that past behavior would predict future behavior. In other words, those that have committed to this population, to serving these patients, would continue to be able to and have funding that would allow them to keep their head above water.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I certainly look forward to seeing some of that. But I think, as you've expressed as well, the very tight budget does require some reductions, and I think the issue is fairness and how they are applied. And in your particular area, the concern I have is that some get it and some don't. And so I think that as far as there may be being a reduction, I'm not speaking to that in general, but to its distribution. So maybe, Representative Bunn, I wanted to give you a little moment to at least sit in your chair. And if you have either some information now or some other ideas, I'd like to hear that as well, if that's okay.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Gesko was singing your praises before you got
here. Well, I just want to say I had a county association that wanted to meet with me immediately on a bill at 9 a.m., and I just heard that at 10 o'clock last night, so that's why I'm late. I was meeting on a bill. But so the question is about whether or not, are you comparing it to what the governor suggested in terms of the extension of who's available? What was the original question you had, Representative?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Bunn. Yeah, the question was the fact that Dr. Tesco, before you came in, testified that some were able to get the continuing critical access dollars, even in a reduced amount they would get some, and that health partners or others like that would not be able to have any access to it whatsoever. And so I'd express my concern about that, and that it seemed more fair that you would distribute these dollars, even reduced as they are, but that at least everybody would have a distribution of it. That was the main.
Right. Well, to that question, we actually, this bill was up yesterday afternoon in Health and Human Service Policy. We did an amendment yesterday to my bill to ensure that, so the bill that was up yesterday was kind of the alternative to the governor's proposal, wanting to find more savings, even more than we had done last year in this area. Dental took the largest percentage hit of any part of the budget last year in Health and Human Services. But we were trying to find even additional savings in the program, as did the governor's budget. And the governor's budget greatly restricted to only nonprofits. Mostly it would be in the metro. It had issues for both outstate, but also excluded all large unit systems like health partners and others, that many of which serve over 10,000 clients. It also excluded the governor's language, the University of Minnesota and its satellite dental programs around the state, including outstate areas. So what we did, we took a different approach in terms of the number of public program persons they're required to serve to be eligible, but also had specific language to ensure that the University of Minnesota and its clinics and units that are serving currently over 10,000, whether they're nonprofit or private, could continue to be included in the program while still greatly reducing, you know, the getting savings in the program. So we did do a much more fair approach and also approach that would make sure there was adequate Greater Minnesota coverage as well.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bunn. I appreciate that, and I'll take a look at that. My concern, though, is in rural Minnesota, this 10,000 is a very difficult thing to meet. And in rural Minnesota, those are some of the issues. But I'm willing to take a look at that. I'm just glad to hear and want to affirm the approach of doing that. Another approach is mentioned to me as well. Again, some of these programs and these things, you know, some of the other dentists have shared that why don't we just distribute these dollars to all dentists and so that they can all have the same opportunity to provide services.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bunn.
Again, Mr. Chair, Representative, specifically to the outstate issue, the language in our proposal currently is initial language about 40% in terms of patient contacts have to be public programs. Beyond that, if you serve over 10,000, you also are still eligible. And beyond that, we have specific language to address the rural issue that if you don't meet those other two criteria, but there's not a critical access provider within 60 miles, you can still be designated as well to make sure there's enough rural dispersion of critical access providers. So there's language to specifically address the outstate rural issue, whether or not they meet the other two criteria.
We will have a hearing.
Yes, I suspect. I didn't want to have a discussion anymore, but thank you.
Okay. Representative Hunley, may
yes.
I just wanted to mention a couple of things in the conversation that just took place. I just wanted to point out that Health Partners Dental Group is a part of Health Partners Organization, which, of course, is not for profit. And secondly, that we are approaching, as we approached last year, this issue in a way that understands the crisis that we're facing in Minnesota. We took significant cuts last year, and we proposed those cuts because we were approaching it realistically, and we are again. We are looking at all sources to balance things such that this is a cost-neutral change. We're very aware of anything that would add cost to the system would not even be considered. And so I think our approach is one of reason and fairness. Thank you.
Okay. I have a question for Mr. Freeman. What is the Merck cut to regions? And how many, if you know, how many different residencies do you have there?
I'm Representative Huntley and committee members. I'm sorry, I don't have those numbers in front of me. I can get them to you. I don't have them right here. Sorry.
Representative Bunn.
Just the last point on that, in terms of contrast with the government, I assume we'll comment on the governor's proposal. That's why we're here today, on the budget proposal. The other thing is the House proposal has reform language in it that doesn't exist in the governor's proposal in terms of trying to make sure there's some fraud and abuse type language that's in there as well for both eligibility and for termination. It was some that was discussed with the agency last year. There's been various versions of it, but we have contained that in our proposal this year, and it wasn't in the governor's proposal.
Okay. Well, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And next it's Ed Eide from the Mental Health Association.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ed Eide. I'm with the Mental Health Association of Minnesota. I'm sorry we have to be here today, but I thank you all for being so gracious and allowing us all to testify. I'm here to speak against the governor's supplemental budget. This budget hurts people who cannot afford to be hurt more. On Tuesday, we received a phone call from a woman who has schizoaffective disorder. And she called on Tuesday. It was very difficult for her to make the call, but she called on Tuesday because her nurse didn't show up on Monday. And so she had her PCA services cut off and didn't know that that was going to happen. She thought maybe she had gotten a letter about that, but wasn't certain. We tried to call her back, and we couldn't get a hold of her. She had given us permission to call her sister, and we called her sister, And her sister couldn't get a hold of her. Now, her sister's taking care of her mother, who has Alzheimer's. So she doesn't have the capability of taking care of her sister, who has schizoaffective disorder. It's been 3 days now, and we still can't get a hold of this woman. That's the beginning of the cuts that we're going to see. And we're going to get calls like that at the Mental Health Association on a daily basis. We just hope we don't lose people. The proposal that the governor submitted is not governance. Most of us want to leave places better than we found them. I've been in the human service area for 30 years. I've left every place I've worked, which is only three in that time frame, better than I found it. The governor's not doing that. This budget is not that. He may be leaving, but you all are still going to be here. You're going to have to pick up the pieces. Reducing caddy waivers from 90 a month to 60 a month hurts people. Making a third of the total cuts come from reducing people on Minnesota Care due to a change from 225% of poverty to 75% of poverty hurts people. This, linked with the elimination of GAMC, removes people from any type of health care. What do we expect people to do? Disappear? They will. My son and daughter-in-law just had a baby, grandfather for the first time. She was 5 weeks early. Now, they're really lucky they have good health care. Baby spent 2 weeks in the hospital, but because they have good health care, the baby's home and doing fine. They're willing to have their taxes increased to provide for other people who don't have their type of health care. Steve Hayes and Denise Miller testified on Tuesday about their adult sons who have severe disabilities. You remember their testimony. It's very disheartening. They are working to take care of their sons. This doesn't affect just people on the street who are homeless. It affects families and can destroy families. Letters will be sent out soon to remove people from GAMC. People who are homeless will not get those letters, as Monica Nielsen showed the Senate, and I think the House, too, earlier. So they show up in the emergency room for services, and what will they get? Maybe an application to Minnesota Care. And then how do they send the application to Minnesota Care in because they don't even have a stamp to mail it? They aren't going to go down to the government center and drop it, I would guess. Plus, they have to wait 4 months for that services to kick in. Plus, with the reduction of elimination of GA, how would they even pay the copay? They won't. It'll be uncompensated care, which is basically a tax on everyone who has health care. California is suggesting right now, Blue Cross of California is suggesting a 39% increase in their rates. That's going to come. Again, it's still a tax. It's just a different form of taxing. My mother's 93 years old and lives alone, and until the last year, she snowblowed her own driveway. She has great health care. She has better health care than I do, and it keeps her independent. But if this budget goes through, the sickest among us will isolate more. People will be sicker, and I dare say we'll die. I live in a condo in downtown Minneapolis, and one of our neighbors who had severe chemical and mental health issues committed suicide. He was not found for 3 weeks. That's going to happen. We're going to hear stories about that. It affects us directly. This supplementary budget is actually incredibly poor economics. If we're laying people off, they're going to collect unemployment if they're eligible. So instead of money coming into the system, more money is going to come out of the system. It's very simple. And tax me. I'm willing to. I have a job. My wife has a job. People who have means should pay a fair share. Last session, you passed a bill to require DHS to hire 12 SMRT staff, or 16, I'm sorry, 16. It's now been cut to 12, and not one of them has been hired to date. So that means we can't move people who are disabled to appropriate care. I would encourage you to encourage DHS to fill those slots. Now, we understand this because of a computer problem that needed to be upgraded, and they wanted to wait until the computer system was available before they hired people to work within the computer system. Meanwhile, we have people stacking up, not getting appropriate services. Fill the slots. We, last night, you all put another GAMC bill together, and I must say how exciting that is that it's not dead. And Dr. Sulik testified, I don't know if it was Tuesday or Monday or the week before, that the average cost is $1,000 a day in the SOS facilities, and the average length is between $16,000 and $20,000 an episode. Surely we can find less expensive services for people with mental illnesses. It's available out there. If the governor will not govern, it's up to you to lead. Lead by putting together and pass a budget that harms the least, adds revenue streams, and keeps the so-called safety net in place. You were elected to make those tough decisions. And the short-sighted views that are in the supplemental budget are going to harm all of us. And I don't think anyone in this room would object to paying more taxes to keep services in place. And I don't think anyone in this room would actually feel that there are people undeserving of health care. Everyone deserves health care. Thank you for your time.
Questions? Representative Bond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And is Dr. Eady, how do you spell it?
Mr. Eady.
Eady.
It's okay.
Okay, Mr. Eady. Just a comment in terms of wanting to raise revenues to not do these cuts at this time. If it was just, I appreciate that, and I appreciate all your comments today. They were excellent. But given the out biennium situation, and if you, any of you that saw the Tribune article from about 6 weeks ago, that if we raise, put every tax that had been suggested for the last 10 years on the table, again, it would, you know, be about $2 billion. And we're looking at, in real terms with inflation as of this week's forecast, approximately $7 billion shortfall in the next biennium. So I just want us all in the room to keep in mind that even with the revenue raisers, we're still talking about cuts well beyond that are being talked about in the governor's supplement budget this year or in what the House or Senate will be offering this year. So I'm not sure we can do the saves or the kinds of things that you're suggesting we could do just in terms of the numbers, the way they add up. And I just want us to all keep that in mind as we go forward.
Appreciate that. Yeah.
Representative Skidmire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I hear your passion and your concern for the clients that you serve, and it's commendable to hear that from you. And I think that Representative Bunn, you're exactly right. This is something, and I think we all care. We all care very much. And I think our goal is to serve our populations in the most cost-effective way we can, but it's not about not serving them. It's about finding that way, that solution, that can help us to preserve that and yet be fiscally responsible. So I think those are two challenging things to work through. So, but thank you for your compassion and care, and we share that with you.
I understand, but we are cutting people off services.
Yeah.
And we can't say that we aren't.
Thank you. Next we have, I don't think Dr. Gonzalez is here, but I see Michael, Dr. Belzer.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Michael Belzer. I'm the medical director of Hennepin County Medical Center, and I've had that position for 20 years. Next to me is Mike Haristall, who's our vice president of public policy and strategy. Thank you for allowing us to testify this morning on the governor's proposed supplemental budget. We certainly, as others, recognize that the state the dilemma that the state faces with respect to the projected shortfall, but nevertheless we have grave concerns about the course that has been taken that disproportionately impacts the health and human services investment in our population and institutions that serve them. Frankly, although I suppose we probably shouldn't have been, we were surprised at the magnitude of cuts again in the health and human services area, again to hospitals, and again specifically to safety net hospitals, following the decisions that have been made in the past regarding the devastation of the safety net. And I agree with the previous speaker about government's role to protect not harm their citizens. You're familiar with the role that Hancock County Medical Center plays in trauma, emergency preparedness, service to the uninsured and underinsured, and the fact that we provide the largest volume of services to the uninsured in the Minnesota healthcare programs, nearly 20% of the state's total uninsured burden. We're the third largest clinical site for postgraduate education training, training of residents in the state, and more than one half of the state's physicians have done some or all of their training on our campus at Hennepin County Medical Center. Hennepin County Medical Center, standing as a public hospital, enables the state to draw $66 million in federal matching dollars that are distributed to other hospitals, community clinics, and other state services, precisely that we are able to match $72 million, and only $6 million of those $72 million come back to Hennepin County Medical Center. The other $60 million or so gets distributed to other hospitals and community clinics. As you know, we've been on a journey of transformation that has assured efficient and effective health care. The legislation that you allowed us in 2005 to form the Hennepin Health System has given us a governance structure that creates flexibility to improve performance, and we've been doing that as cost increases have been below health care inflation rates. We've been actively engaged in the health work and the policy work of this committee and others in the healthcare reform, and we're providing efficient services to patients at the appropriate site of care. Our clinic system having 10 primary care clinic sites and seeing almost 400,000 patients each year. We've shown you documents that, and we've passed out some, that the role that we play in serving the uninsured, chart one, and the uninsured, specifically the General Assistance Medical Program, and we appreciate the hard work that you're doing to help remedy that problem on chart two. And we've already had to solve for $88 million in annual payment reductions when you consider that we're paid at 2002 costs less 15% and the rate of overall health care inflation, which is demonstrated in chart three. We've already cut our operation to the bone. The low-hanging fruit has been plucked, and we're trying to limp along to figure out how we can maintain the services that we provide to the disadvantaged patients as well as the community. And we've talked to you earlier about the crisis we face, and this budget, quite frankly, moves us from crisis to catastrophe. Specifically, the cuts in the proposed budget would result in another $10 or $12 million reduction in the annual payments to Hennepin County Medical Center, 3% reduction in medical assistance rates, delayed rebasing, elimination of quarterly payments, and the loss of Minnesota Care eligibility for another 21,000 individuals. And if we take a look at the annual group on general assistance medical care, that's almost another 100,000 who will have their health insurance taken from them. Each represents a seven-figure reduction needed for patient service revenues at our institution. The single largest impact is MERC, the Medical Education Research Costs Fund payments, which by itself alone would cost our institution $7.5 million. And I'm sure you're aware that the payment for Hennepin County Medical Center is generated, the MERC payment is generated through the PMAP carve-out, the mechanism that was intentionally enabled by the state state and federal statute to direct the Medicaid dollars to teaching institutes based on the number of residents as well as the Medicaid patient population. So if you take a look at the chart on page two and just calculate what our annual loss will be between previous actions of the governor and the proposed supplemental budget. I don't think I need to walk you through this because I'm sure you're familiar with it. It approaches almost $55 million a year, which is more than 10% of our annual operating budget. Most of you are probably aware that we did our due diligence. We sent out letters to surrounding metropolitan counties because I'm sure you're aware there's no Anoka County General Hospital and there's no Wright County Medical Center. We serve as the safety net for the metropolitan community. And each of the counties responded as we expected they would without an offer to help share the cost, but that they believed that the indigent care burden was the responsibility of the state and they would help us with that obligation. Our legal counsel and other legal counsel opinion corroborates that responsibility, that it is a state responsibility, and abrogating and backing away from that responsibility is one that we find difficult to maneuver around. So specifically, the consequences of the defunding and accelerated dismantling of the safety net includes, one, the mortality increase. I've spoken to this committee numerous times about how uninsurance is a fatal disease. Latest estimates are that 45,000 U.S. residents die each year solely because they don't have health insurance. That's one individual every 12 seconds, even when you control for age, sex, health habits. Higher total costs, even though the state costs will decrease. There'll be increased costs to local government, social services, police, corrections, and health care. You've heard those individuals mention that. Increased health care costs and health insurance premiums. Gated clinic system in Hennepin County Medical Center. I'm sure you've heard that we're about to do that. We've had our initial meetings where it's heartbreaking to us to have to do that. But since our sole source of backup funding is the county, we are going to need to tie the safety net for outpatient, non-emergency care, and outpatient services around Hennepin County and figure out some way to let non-Hennepin County citizens know that. Again, that's very heartbreaking to do. As you know, there'll be more patients presenting in the emergency room, program closure and downsizing, specifically those programs that don't have positive margins, which will not only be those programs that affect the poor, but those programs that this community and state has come to rely on in terms of emergency preparedness, trauma, burn center, acute psychiatric services. We also have reduced resources for educating health professionals, not only physicians, but non-MDs. We train thousands of those each year. And then there's the regression from health care reform principles. So one of our asks of you is that you recognize that mechanisms have been created to provide for the sustainability of safety net providers. That's the high public program and uncompensated care providers and those that get disproportionate share payments and intergovernmental transfers. We hope that those payments, what's left of them, be directed for those services. And beyond that, if there's no temporary restitution or restoration of Hennepin or of general assistance medical care, there'll be the need to create sustenance for other safety net providers via uncompensated care pools or emergency funds to protect the solvency, and I do mean solvency, not just the ability to maintain the programs we have, but the solvency of safety net providers. So health and human services budgets and hospital budgets specifically have already suffered the major cuts and the disproportionate cuts from the governor's budget. And the course suggested by this new supplemental budget will only mean further deterioration in the health status of our citizens, fewer health professionals trained, and more folks with severe illness seeking care in our emergency room and unquestionably premature deaths. So thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. If there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. Mr. Harris-Saul would as well.
Could you tell me the estimate of the people you've already laid off in anticipation of this and how much further that's going to go?
If you're talking about employees?
Employees, yes.
I think our last round, Mike, was somewhere around 200. Is that correct?
That's correct, and we are having very active conversations right now back at the hospital as to what we will be having to do, assuming the GAMC program sunsets. So the 200, unfortunately, was probably the first wave.
And we suspect there might be another 150 or more that we're looking at this time with the potential for GAMC in the supplemental budget.
I've heard that graduating nurses can't find jobs.
Surprising, isn't it?
That's a change from 3 years ago.
Absolutely. When people were going out of the country, Commissioner, to try to find nurses, it's a staggering thought.
Other questions? Okay, well, I don't see any, but I will say, I don't know if I told you this before, but I was meeting with Range and Duluth physicians 4 or 5 years ago, and I asked the people in the room how many of them had got part of their training at Hennepin County Medical Center, and it was 3/4 of the people in the room.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, I want to comment, too. In a way, I also got part of my training at Hennepin County Medical Center because I actually worked there when it was Hennepin County General Hospital. Mm. I worked in the pediatric outpatient clinic.
Oh. Goodness.
So as a nursing assistant while I was in college, so I have a great appreciation for what you do and how important your institution is.
Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment to how this is all kind of playing out in regards to medical education. I have a very bright young nephew who graduated from Johns Hopkins and had the opportunity to go to medical school here, but saw the lack of investment that the state is putting in higher education in particular, and chose to go to the University of Maryland. So we talk about the brain drain. You know, I don't know if we'll get him back. And that's a real loss for our state.
Okay, well, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And next, it's Sue Abner Holden from NAMI.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sue Abner Holden, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I have props this morning. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify. As you know, NAMI is a statewide grassroots organization dedicated to improving the lives of children and adults with mental illnesses and their families. And nearly 100% of our board and staff either live with a mental illness or have a family member with a mental illness. 1 in 4 adults and 1 in 10 children have a mental illness severe enough to disrupt their ability to live, work, learn in our communities. I want you to take just a minute to imagine developing a serious mental illness. Maybe you're hearing voices or are delusional. You might have racing thoughts or a pounding heart. Perhaps you're weighed down by a heavy invisible blanket that slows every movement. You can't work, so you lose your job, so you have no income, and you'll probably then lose your health insurance as well. And without insurance, you can't pay for the medications and treatment that will help you get better. Without income, you lose your housing. Your symptoms make it difficult to focus, to have the energy to carry out simple daily activities to keep track of time. It could also be your child who flies into rages or cuts herself or simply shuts himself off from the rest of the world. Your child may need day or residential treatment, treatment that your insurance may not pay for. Your child is having difficulty in school and at home, and you need help to keep your child safe. Not even 3 years ago, in a bipartisan effort with both the governor and the legislature working together, the Mental Health Initiative passed. The mental health community was full of hope that finally the state was going to address the fragility and inadequacies of our mental health system. But after reading the governor's budget, that hope has turned into despair. We do not want to push our mental health system to the edge of a cliff. I have a picture of Minnesota's new mental health system. It's Lucy from the Peanuts cartoon, where she has a psychiatric practice. And I want to think you to think about not only the cuts in this budget, but the $9 million that was included in the General Assistance Medical Care Bill and the $9 million for child welfare and children's mental health in that bill as well. I'd like to say that this is the investment. First it was 5 cents, then it was 4, and now it's 3. These budget cuts to mental health may seem like peanuts. I want you to remember me today. In the big picture of the budget, but to us, they really mean the world, and people's lives depend on mental health and mental health services. So think about no general assistance for those who have no income and no assets. Many live with a mental illness. Applying for Social Security is really, really hard, and it's not unusual to have your application rejected once, twice, 3 times, or more. It's usually not until someone gets help from an attorney that they are able to successfully appeal, and this can take more than 2 years. No general assistance medical care for those who pretty much have no income and no housing. NAMI has testified before that simply moving people onto Minnesota care won't work. Your illness prevents you from navigating the complex waters of healthcare applications where you need to be organized, focused, and cognizant of timelines. No Minnesota care for people above 75% of poverty. So if you've been able to start working again, perhaps part-time because it's too hard with your symptoms to work full-time, now you're not going to qualify for health care benefits. There is a large percentage of people on Minnesota care who take medications to treat their mental illness. And without medications, people will not be able to work. And, well, I think you get the picture. Fewer CADI waivers for those children and adults with mental illnesses who need a significant amount of help to stay in the community, which costs much less than the course of a hospitalization. An average stay at a community behavioral health hospital costs between $16,000 to $20,000 an episode. Fewer children's case managers due to the cuts in the children's case management funds, and fewer children's mental health services due to the cuts in the Children Community Services Block Grant. 16% of those funds are used to fund children's mental health services. I sometimes think if mental illness was easily seen, say a huge sore on one's face, I think more people would care and would be outraged at the discrimination and lack of treatment for people with mental illnesses. But the fact is, no one really cares about the mental health system until they or a loved one develops a mental illness and they need treatment and supports. And when you need it, regardless of your income level or your politics, you want the best, most appropriate care when and where you need it. In the future, I fear that the only beds that will be available for sure for people with mental illnesses will be a jail bed. Before I close, I want to share Tyler's story. Tyler has bipolar disorder, PTSD, anxiety, and chemical dependency. He wanted to come share his story, but the thought of speaking in front of a group, even one this small, really just caused too much anxiety. Tyler experienced some trauma at the age of 5 and began exhibiting symptoms of mental illness at age 13 and was then diagnosed. Due to his anxiety, he was homeschooled. He was stable for several years, was on medication, and even worked 20 hours a week at Target. Around age 18, he stopped taking his medication and replaced them with illegal drugs, marijuana, things like that. He went in and out of treatment programs and finally found an outpatient program that works, one that focuses on harm reduction instead of a 12-step, and that provided a limited amount of mental health treatment. Right now, he's on general assistance and general assistance medical care and would be homeless if not for his friend's couch. He applied for SSI 2 years ago and was denied, but he lost track of time and failed to appeal in time. So he reapplied and has been denied twice more. He now has an attorney, and his appeal will be heard next month. Tyler, though, doesn't really want to be considered disabled. He wants to go back to school and get a job. He has dreams like any 21-year-old, an apartment, a job, a girlfriend, and a cool car. He's very worried about what will happen if he loses his general assistance and general assistance medical care. How will he be able to live? How will he be able to pay for his medication? And what could I tell him? Not to worry, that it would be all right. All I could say is that NAMI would tell his story and the stories of countless others who will be negatively affected by the governor's budget. Behind me are families that could be impacted. Sue, whose son with schizophrenia started his long journey by using general assistance and general assistance medical care. Anita, whose son has schizoaffective disorder and who uses the medical assistance program for employed people with disabilities. Patricia, whose son is one paycheck away and one incredible, generous employer away from having no health care at all. And he's looking now for financial help because his co-pays for his one medication is $100. Mary Jean, whose son has schizoaffective disorder and who is on Minnesota care and general assistance. And Deb, whose brother recently lost his life to suicide. Please remember all of these people and more as you develop your budget. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Cindy, so thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next is Tony Carter, Ramsey County Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members, Patricia Coldwell, Association of Minnesota Counties. I'm standing in or sitting in for Commissioner Carter, who is not able to be here today. And I have Judith Brumfield here with me from MACS, with the Social Services Directors. And then in the interest of time, instead of Julie Ring, We would like to have Dr. Courtney Jordan speak about the SHIP program, and then Julie is here in case there are questions about that. I wanted to just make a couple of introductory comments, and then because when this committee met to hear testimony earlier, you heard from Mary Regan about the Community Children's and Community Services Act programs related to child welfare, mental health, adult protection, disabilities, and there were several questions and comments about that, so I really wanted to allow most of the time that I was going to take to Judith to give a little bit more detail about that and give people an opportunity to answer questions about that, because people were asking Mary questions and she was basically saying that the counties would have information about that, and so we do. So just a couple of introductory comments. I just wanted to say, as many other people have said, that we think that the governor's budget violates many principles that we would consider in trying to manage in difficult times. Doesn't maintain a safety net, doesn't maintain some kind of an infrastructure that could be rebuilt in other times. It shifts costs to both future years and other levels of government. It fails to make any bold decisions that maybe wouldn't fly in better times, so it's kind of a lost opportunity. Basically, we think that it's long on short-term solutions and short on new ideas. In particular, counties have problems with making permanent the $22.5 million CCSA unallotment and also making permanent the unallotment of child support enforcement administrative funds, reducing MinnesotaCare eligibility for adults without children to cover those only at 75% of the federal poverty level, eliminating general assistance and converting it to a short-term one-time crisis grant, reducing or delaying several of the mental health grants, and then, of course, the continuing care rate reductions, and then also reducing the funding for the statewide health improvement plan. Of these, the CCSA cut and the child support administrative funds and SHIP probably affect the county budget most directly. I do want to point out that the CCSA reduction comes on top of $125 million reduction proposed by the governor in county program aid, which is the jurisdiction of the tax committee. That reduction would leave about 18 counties, including Hennepin as the largest county and Traverse as the smallest, with no county program aid remaining. And then actually statewide 28% of county program aid dollars are used to support human services, so there's an interrelationship there. Again, as others have, I ask the legislature as a whole to consider whether the Health and Human Services budget should have to bear such a large share of the reductions. We think that the societal and economic costs of those reductions would be felt in many other areas, ranging from children not ready to learn to increased law enforcement costs to, of course, higher health care costs for employers. With that, I think I'll turn it over to Judith to add some more comments about social services reductions.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for this opportunity. I'm Judith Brownfield. I'm the Deputy Director of Health and Human Services in Scott County, and here today representing the interests of counties in helping you to understand better what the governor's budget proposal would do to services to individuals. As counties, we are very well aware of the difficult and necessary budget decisions that you will have to make. And as counties, we also are making those types of budget decisions. We do appreciate, though, the opportunity to share some of the impacts of those kinds of decisions on the communities that we serve. The people we serve are the first ones to lose jobs during a recession, to lose housing, to lose health care, and the last ones to find employment again. The counties are facing pressures at a community level that will only be worsened under the governor's budget. Service levels that we currently have don't meet the needs of our constituents, and we are also experiencing increased demand for services. CCSA, the Children Community Services Grant, that was talked about earlier in hearings, is a grant that is absolutely critical to meeting the service needs of the individuals who live in Minnesota. Minnesota's most vulnerable citizens are the ones who are served by this grant. The services provided by counties are mandatory services. They're services that are required by both state and federal statute, and failure to provide those services leaves not only the counties but the state subject to fiscal penalties. Most importantly, the failure to provide these necessary services hurt people. We'll reduce the ability to earn federal revenue for reimbursing some of those services, which makes a cascading effect on the impact of people. Some of those impacts include long waiting lists for waiver services for adults and children with disability. CCSA funds help to pay for day services for adults who are leaving our educational program and who may be on a waiting list, which could be 5 to 10 years in length, for waiver services. The impact of the governor's proposed cuts on the CCSA grant will mean that individuals graduating from high school this spring with developmental disabilities will not be provided with a day program. That means the parents of those individuals who may be currently employed will have the choice to leave their employment or to seek residential placement for that young adult. Residential placement will be at medical assistance cost, which is far more costly than to provide a day program, and it is a far less client-friendly service for these individuals. Counties are currently implementing hiring freezes because we are faced with previous budget cuts and know that others are coming. Some of those hiring freezes are in our child protection area. If these cuts are sustained, if the unallotment to CCSA is made permanent, some of those positions in child protection will not be filled. The CCSA grant currently covers, or about 72% of that grant goes toward child welfare services, including both child protection and children's mental health. With cuts in county program aid and CCSA, along with the levy limits that counties face, counties are not going to be able to backfill these reductions. Some of the cost-effective interventions that we've been able to implement over the last few years are some of the first ones to go, such as family group decision making and parent support outreach, which are programs that prevent children coming to the child protection system and prevent out-of-home placement. But the money will be redirected to providing out-of-home placement for those most critically compromised for their safety. The poor economy and high unemployment rate means fewer jobs are available for individuals who are compromised due to disabilities, mental or physical or chemical health issues. CCSA funds are used then to provide supported employment for many of these individuals. Some of this supported employment leads to jobs and eventual self-support. The cut to CCSA grants mean counties will no longer be able to provide this sort of supported employment experience for those people who cannot currently find jobs in our job market. The mental health grants used by counties to provide housing support and other support services for individuals to help maintain them in the community. With the cut to the mental health grants that are being proposed, counties will no longer be able to provide housing support. These individuals will become homeless. Many of them will return to state-operated services, to state hospitals, or will be the ones who fill the mental health beds in our hospitals, and you just heard testimony about the impact of that. The reduction in housing subsidies and it will increase homelessness. We will reduce the subsidized employment for individuals with mental health. We'll terminate the drop-in centers, which provide socialization, early identification, and early intervention for those people who are struggling with mental health issues. They'll become more isolated in the community, and no one will notice the problem until they come to an emergency room and need admission to a hospital. These reductions will increase our hospital costs then, which are far more costly services to individuals. Termination of the General Assistance Program will increase homeless youth and adult populations. Not only does this hurt people, it is extremely bad for the business climate in Minnesota to have a number of homeless individuals on our street corners. So we're not looking just at the harm to people, we're looking at the overall harm to our economy and our way of living in Minnesota. Thank you.
Questions? Dr. Jordan is next, and unfortunately, I have to go across the street. And Representative Rood will be running the rest of the meeting. And if you have, because I really wanted to hear you, very interested in CHIP, and if you have written stuff, send it to me.
Okay. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Over here. All right. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Courtney Jordan, and I'm a member of the Minneapolis State Health Improvement Community Leadership Team.
I also chair the SHIP Healthcare Work Group, which is funded to ensure that clinics and health systems change policy and protocol to prevent obesity. I'm here today on behalf of the city, county, and tribal public health departments and across the state. I am also a practicing cardiologist, and on a daily basis, I see how obesity and tobacco abuse affect the lives of my patients. If there's only one point that you take away from this presentation today, I'd like you to understand that research shows that nearly 70 to 85% of chronic disease can be prevented by four risk factors: tobacco, physical activity, nutrition, and excessive drinking. As a member of the Minneapolis SHIP Community Leadership Team, I'm here today to highlight the impact of the governor's proposed $10 million to cut the SHIP grant. SHIP is an integral part of healthcare reform that seeks to make policy and systems change to prevent the drivers of chronic disease, obesity, and tobacco use. The SHIP program is being implemented by city, county, and tribal public health departments across Minnesota. In Minneapolis, we're in the midst of implementing a range of activities to create environments conducive to healthy weight and decrease tobacco use. Some examples include the following: improving physical activity and nutrition policies and practices at 9 PICA Head Start centers, 300 privately owned child care programs, and 15 charter and alternative schools, as well as the Minneapolis Public School District. Improving access to healthy foods by increasing land available for community gardening and improving mechanisms to support production, distribution, and preservation of local foods. Pursuing voluntary smoke-free policies at 13 Minneapolis Public Housing Authority properties and 7 independently owned properties affecting over 12,000 residents. Improving availability of healthy foods at 4 convenience stores, which will be a model pilot for improving the quality of food sold in these venues. Piloting healthy vending at 10 Minneapolis Park and Recreation Centers in preparation for a system-wide park policy. And ensuring that clinics, especially those that serve low-income, high-risk patients who are disproportionately affected by chronic disease, are consistently assessing for obesity and referred for clinical or community-based programs for healthy eating and physical activity. Cutting funding for this program just as it's getting started would mean delaying or stopping some of these interventions. In addition to reducing the burden of chronic disease, SHIP is designed to control healthcare costs. Maintaining the investment in SHIP is a prudent long-term strategy for managing healthcare costs within the state budget. I also want to draw your attention to the Statewide Health Improvement Program 2010 legislative report just released by the Minnesota Department of Health. It outlines SHIP's activities in every corner of the state, including Minneapolis. Lastly, as an expectant mother of my second child, I feel fortunate that because of my training and expertise, my family will come to value prevention. And again, on a daily basis, I feel that I'm fortunate to be able to impact the behaviors of the individual patients that I see. However, you and your roles on this committee have the capacity to affect policy and health of Minnesotans for years to come that will change the health of these people. Thank you so much for your time and attention.
Thank you very much for your testimony and congratulations. Members have any questions? Representative Prince.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor. I had my county, Rice County, is a recipient of a large grant from this, and I'm concerned that we won't receive the amount that we really, really need. And I, too, have all of my life, in fact, I was a nurse, and I was just telling some folks that some of the folks that I worked with were a little sick of me over the last 35 years in the break room because I, preached eating an orange and exercise and moderation and no smoking and all of those things. But, you know, one person cannot do enough. And so that's why we're here. That's why we had this proposal, and I need that, this program in my county.
Absolutely.
Where I have a 15% Hispanic and a 14% Somali, and then all of the other children and the obesity factor, and I need something, a program like this, to get them moving. And I think we all need that more than ever in all of our districts. Mm-hmm. And we see that our society has become so sedentary that our children aren't out playing. I know I wish Representative Huntley was here. He always tells me the story that one afternoon he and his wife were sitting out in their porch in Duluth, and they heard this noise. They have a piece of land next to them. It was children playing. They hadn't heard that in a long time.
Absolutely.
Thank you for bringing this forward, and I I deeply regret the cuts to this program as well.
Thanks for your comments.
Representative Bunn.
Just real quick, because I think there's a lot more testimony. When this was developed as part of the 2008 reforms, it has bipartisan support, it had governor support. So we certainly will be looking at this closely, and particularly in light of the numbers that were produced by, at that time by our health economics group at Department of Health. My recollection, but Dan's not present still, our staff, was about $760 million potential expected savings throughout our healthcare system, private and public, was expected from this $47 million approximately dollar investment. So, and I thought at the time of those discussions, we were actually going to book part of that savings and forecast, but I'll be checking that again, too, before we make our final budget decisions this year. So I assure you that I will be looking closely at this line item on the budget.
Okay, appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative Bunn. And I think this one of the most frustrating things about being in the position that we're in is, you know, some of this stuff isn't rocket science. You know, we know what works, and it's a shame to think that we're not going to be able to do some of it, but we're going to fight to try to keep it. So thank you for your testimony. Yeah. I just want to, there's a little bit of change in the lineup here. Alexandra Fitzsimmons is unable to be with us today, and we are going to move up Deb Konicki, because she has a young child with her. So please come to the table and welcome to the committee. I think they should.
Okay.
Yeah, this is your
test. Well, my name is Deb Konicki. Thank you for accommodating us. I was hoping my daughter would come up with me, but she's a little shy. So, I am testifying today both for Welfare Rights Committee, which is an organization of low-income women who we have been fighting to stop the attacks on welfare for nearly 20 years now at the Capitol, and also the Minnesota Coalition for People's Bailout, which is a coalition of low-income, student, immigrant rights, religious, tenant, and peace and justice organizations that Welfare Rights Committee is a part of. as we all know, and thank you for the opportunity to testify, as we all know, we are experiencing the greatest economic crisis since the Great Depression. Tens of thousands of us are losing jobs, facing layoffs, running out of unemployment, facing loss of housing. It is poor and working people who are suffering the most from this economic crisis. And as usual, it is the wealthy who are affected the least, and even profit during our greatest time of economic stress. Yet it is those of us who are suffering the most from this crisis that Governor Pawlenty has said must pay for the state's budget deficit. This newest budget proposal is one more in a long line of sick, disastrous proposals by Governor Pawlenty. It is an attack on the poor. It is an attack on working people. It is an attack on people with disabilities, an attack on women, an attack on mothers, and it is an attack on children. When does this madness stop? Pawlenty's budget proposes to eliminate general assistance for over 20,000 Minnesotans. GA pays a measly $203 a month to individuals who are disabled and extremely poor and unable to work. Pawlenty proposes to cut survival income from children and their caregivers who are both poor and have disabilities. His proposal every month out of the welfare grant for families on MFIP who have a disabled family member receiving SSI. So his proposal says that every dollar of the SSI grant should then come out of the MFIP grant. The fact is that a family of three, including one who has a disability, gets only $437 a month in the MFIP welfare grant for the other two family members. Pawlenty's proposal would essentially wipe out the entire $437 welfare grant, forcing the entire family to live on the nominal SSI check belonging to the member with a disability. A cut such as this has never been carried out in any other state in the country. It basically forces parents to break federal law by using the federal SSI grant for living expenses for the entire family rather than for the needs of the family member with the disability as intended. Many families are forced to go on welfare because the caregiver or a child has a disability and they are therefore unable to work. These are cruel, inhumane cuts that punish individuals and families in poverty and people with disabilities. And who it will hurt the most is the children, like my daughter, like other children. Pawlenty also proposes to eliminate a state program for food for legal non-citizens in poverty. And again, he proposes to steal tens of millions of dollars from the federal TANF dollars that the state receives to provide public assistance for parents and their children in poverty. He then uses that money to supplant state spending. His proposal would also cut tens of thousands of low-income working Minnesotans off of Minnesota health care. Meanwhile, the richest in this state continue to go untouched. Every budget deficit has been balanced on the backs of poor and working people of Minnesota, while the wealthiest have not paid one dime. In fact, they've amassed more wealth at our expense. Permanent tax breaks going to the rich have made them richer and have cost the state billions and billions in revenue. Poor and disabled working people of this state, we are paying with our blood, while the wealthy are swimming in their profits. It is long past the time to stop this madness. Every single legislator in this capital has constituents who are being hit by the economic crisis, no matter which party you are from. As more of us fall into unemployment, run out of unemployment benefits, the more we are in need of these very programs. Politicians should be expanding the programs to help Minnesotans in a time of economic downturn instead of cutting them. Politicians should make those with the ability to pay for the deficit, which they haven't yet. We have the solution for the budget deficit, and that is to tax the rich. So our suggestion is do not follow the leader. It is clear that we have a governor who's willing to sacrifice the good people of our state for his own political gains. It is clear the governor is leading the charge in a war against poor and working Minnesotans, and he doesn't care how many casualties there are. Really, he is sinking Minnesota, and as the so-called captain of the ship, Pawlenty is planning not to go down with it. He's going to jump ship and let the rest of us perish. So it's time for a mutiny at the Capitol. It's time for people of all party, of both parties and all parties, to stand up against this. As the elected representatives of the people in this state, you do not have to go along with this. In fact, you have a responsibility in your position of power to resist this path of destruction. It is time to say enough is enough, reject these criminal cuts, and make the rich pay. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions, Representative Bunn? And members, everyone, I just want you to know there are some other committees going on, and some members have to take votes, so that's why you are seeing some people who aren't here and who are leaving in and out, and we also have some negotiations going on, as you may be aware of, with the governor. So I apologize for the sparsity of our committee, but we will make sure that members do have any written testimony that is submitted today as well. So thank you. And what's your daughter's name?
Eliana.
Oh, she's so good. This is democracy in action, so maybe someday you're going to be up here. Thank you for being here.
I just want to say what an articulate message that was.
Yes.
It was a very well done and very well written and articulate message.
And do you have written testimony to submit? Are you planning to submit your
do you mean this as written? I can.
Sure.
Can I send it to Jan?
Yep.
Email?
Sure.
Okay.
That would be great. Thank you very much. And next up, I think we have Ms. Megan. Is that correct? Okay. Thank you, and welcome to the committee. What's here, anyways?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Lynn Megan. I'm here today representing Minnesota Habilitation Coalition and MNDACA, Minnesota Developmental Achievement Association of Minnesota. We are provider organizations representing day training and habilitation providers throughout the state of Minnesota. Our members serve over 12,500 people around the state with disabilities, serving all 87 counties. DT&H services provide employment, community involvement, therapies, transportation, and other individualized services to some of our most Minnesotans' most vulnerable citizens. I am employed as president of TSE, a community day training and habilitation provider. We provide training support, TSE, training support employment, for over 280 people with disabilities serving Ramsey County. I urge you to oppose the governor's proposed 2.5% rate cut to day training habilitation providers and other disability service providers. This proposed rate cut would be on top of the 2.58% rate cut that we experienced the beginning of this biennium in July of 2009, which already creates significant challenges for all of us as providers. The quality of our services is reliant on our strong management and competence of strong staff teams. Without adequate compensation for providers, we're unable to recruit or retain qualified staff. Direct support staff members on average in Minnesota make less than $10 an hour. For that wage, people are looking for jobs with a lot less stress and personal responsibility. In the majority of our member organizations, wages are frozen. I don't think that any provider passed on the 2009 2.58% cut as a wage cut to our direct support professionals. How could we? Actually, since I wrote this in preparation for testimony last week, I did hear that there are several providers who did cut that minor wage of $10 to by 2%, so a lesser wage for those people already, and you know, others may certainly be behind that. Since 2003, provider organizations have received a cumulative rate increase of 4.94%, while inflation has grown 20.6%. In 2004, there was no rate increase. In 2003 and 2009, rates were cut by 1 and 2.58%, respectively. Governors proposed cutting rates again now to disability provider organizations by an additional 2.5%, we don't want that extra 0.8%, to help balance the budget. We wonder why. As nonprofit organizations, our day training habilitation organizations are well managed and we believe to serve a strong public purpose. In fact, at TSE, our administrative cost is only 8.5% of our budget. If we have another cut, that we're already very efficient, very lean in our administration, so we can provide the majority of our budget to wages for the strongest part of our service areas, our staff people. We are businesses, and we are subject to the same economic challenges faced by private and government sectors. Our fixed costs continue to rise in areas like employee health insurance, fuel, utilities. At the same time, rates and private giving has declined. The effects of the July 2009 2.58% cut across the state, employees have been laid off. Some organizations have dropped health insurance. Other benefits have been reduced. Vacation time reduced, holidays reduced, non-paid furloughs have been implemented, and as I said, wage freezes have been implemented across the state. While working with fewer resources, we must continue to operate under the same laws and rules created when our system was more adequately funded. We do not have the resources to give wage increases without cost of living adjustments, and certainly cannot give wage increase with provider rate cuts. Any future cuts in 2009 will be, especially in our employment area, community jobs that require individuals with who have higher needs, have higher staff ratios, and on the job, that those jobs may be prohibitive because they may not be able to receive those supports that they need. More layoffs, more benefit cuts. Individuals whose authorized service days are cut may lose their placement entirely, as Ms. Brumfield testified to. Staff consumer ratios will be increased. Safety is an issue for physical safety of staff and for people with disabilities, and the opportunities for community involvement will be decreased and in some cases not possible at all. If provider service rates are cut, we want to know what services that the state is asking us to cut. Are we taking away any rules that any government rules that dictate to us on what we need to provide? Minnesotans with disabilities and the organizations that serve them have already borne more than our fair share to help balance the budget in previous years. Another rate cut brings the service system closer to a tipping point. We understand that anticipation of additional service cuts, the Minnesota Department of Human Services is seeking a new staff position to monitor whether the state will be in compliance with federal regulations regarding access to disability services. The majority of our services are financed by the combination of federal and state funds. For every state dollar cut, Minnesota loses access to the federal funds. This is inconsistent with other efforts to maximize federal dollars and to create jobs. If there is another rate cut of any amount in services for people with disabilities, we also risk losing those valuable federal dollar matches. I ask you please not to support the governor's proposed rate cut of 2.5% or any cut to our services as you develop your budget responses. A cut in disability funding is a tax increase to Minnesotans with disabilities, their families, and the people who provide services. People with disabilities that we support depend on your leadership in assuring that service providers they depend on can continue to meet their needs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Some of you that have met in our office this week have heard some of this before, but just a general comment because it relates to many of these areas, the whole rate regarding rate cuts generally. I mean, we have certain tools in our toolbox, you know, rate cuts, elimination of whole programs if they're not federally required, redesign of benefits or, you know, restructuring events, change in benefits or redesign and restructuring service delivery to be lower cost. And maybe I've missed something there you can add. But those are our major tools we have to work with. And I think, you know, I haven't been here with the legislature very long, but I think that rate cuts have often been a very attractive tool because when you're on a short timeline, and particularly if it's a temporary blip in the economy, you know, a 1 or 2 year recession of a more modest size, you know, you say we'll all take a little cut for a while and in a couple of years we'll restore all those cuts and get us back on track and get our COLAs going and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We're experiencing a much different thing right now for two reasons. One is the magnitude of the recession, and secondly is a long-term structural problem with just a kind of flattening revenue sources due to demographic change with an increase in demand for services due to demographic change. So combination of factors going together, and also just the general cost of health care. And then this is confounded with the additional issue that in the areas that you work in, as well as in education, that so much of it is labor cost, you know, and not technology. And how do you find more and more efficiencies when you're in a labor, you know, a human services related area, whether it's teaching or and long-term care and disability care? So we have huge challenges. So I just want to say about the rate cut. So if whether this year or next, I do believe we are threatening our business models in both the healthcare system and the long-term disability care systems by continuing to talk about rate cuts. It's just not viable. It's not fair to the people that work in those sectors. And so we have to look at those other options. You know, within federal requirements, where can we redesign programs, take off onerous mandates if there are some, or paperwork, find other use technologies to be more efficient, whatever it is. But that's the part that we don't know how to do. It's either the agency or you all who are in the field and doing the work know how to do. So whether this session is, I know you every year work on an ongoing basis with your various groups to look at those things, but that's what we need for you in the biggest way possible for the next round next year. To our goal in this committee is going to be to, you know, minimize harm going forward as best possible. We are in terms of the issue of the disproportionate hit to this part of the budget. I mean, we have a 40% portion of the budget with K-12 that's constitutionally required, you know, and we can fudge that a little bit here and there over the years and do various cuts or not give inflation increases to K-12, but we are constitutionally required. So there's only so much leeway. There's only so much leeway with corrections, at least from my not expertise vantage point, at least that's what I'm told. Mm-hmm. And so we are left with this part of the budget being the major player, and it's also the part of the budget that has the growth path that is affecting everything else. So we are all in it together, and so I just welcome, I agree with you on the incredible undesirability of doing any more rate cuts to anyone in these systems as the option, but then it leaves those other tools. And we welcome your expertise and advice this session, but in particular next time and over the interim and early in the interim about you know, what those other tools might be, whether the mandate relief or you know, redesign services or a different set of services that still would meet federal requirements. And as the gentleman said earlier, who I believe is out of the room now, you know, we will also be discontinuing services and discontinuing mm-hmm. services to classes of people that may currently receive them but not federally required. So that is the reality. So thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Bond. And I do have a question when we talk about the mandates and the federal mandates. Are there particular state mandates? There are other areas in our budget where we as a state go above and beyond federal requirements and mandates, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. We start, you know, it's kind of put Minnesota in a leadership position in a good way. But do you have any particular comments on that?
Madam Chair and Representative Bunn, I certainly appreciate all your comments, and we have attempted through the years to work with the Department of Human Services for regulatory relief. I will answer your question. One comment on the side is, however, we as Minnesotans have a high level of expectation.
Absolutely.
And at this point, we're not, and even recipients of service and their family members are not yet willing to go that next step to fund the supports and services that they expect on a daily basis, and our advocates. And we want to provide that best of best service, but we now know that we cannot pay for that best of best service. So we are continually working with people that we serve to be able to focus on that reality of what you're talking about. And Representative Bunn, my colleagues who's at Frith, your constituent, you met with you earlier this week, and you provided her with an assignment, and we will follow through with that. We will give you that information. In regards to that regulatory relief, our waiver that provides many supports and services for people with disabilities is a federal program, and the state is required through our waiver plan to comply with CMS's regulations, or we will no longer be able to have that waiver. So with that comes the rules and regs that provide the safety. It's primarily health and safety for people. We do go beyond that health and safety for people. Our problem is, as we look at regulatory relief, how do we begin to peel back that banana? What part of it is anyone going to be able to say? And our advocates who we want and we work very closely with, what part of it are they going to accept? Again, that is, they're going to say that is not a safe, or that we need to go beyond that. It's beyond a safety issue, and it's the programmatic. We want a well funded system which provides us with a very rich service, and we're unwilling to go back with that at this point.
And thank you for those comments. I mean the last thing I think any of us want is the race to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and,
mm-hmm.
and that's never been Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate those comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next person on the list I have is Ms. Hamilton. Is she here? Nope. Okay. How about Mr. McNeil?
No.
Okay. I think we did.
Deb's
spoke for number 13. Okay. Dr. Jordan? Oh, she already spoke. Amy Nelson? Ms. Nelson? Mr. Hancock? Oh, sure. And I just received a little message in my ear that Ms. Wingert needs to leave. Is that right?
It's over here. Dr. Maynard has that clinic commitment.
Oh, okay. Yes.
We don't need to be out quite this early, but just wondered if we could.
Okay. I think we are going to be wrapping up here because I think we've had an attrition rate here. So if you can. Okay.
Okay.
Does that mean you get me by default, Madam Chair?
Sure. And if you would please identify yourself, please, sir.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is David Hancock. I'm the Executive Director at the Metro Center for Independent Living.
Thank you.
And members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here and share a few remarks this morning. First of all, just very briefly, for your edification, the Metro Center for Independent Living is one of eight centers for independent living located around the state of Minnesota. And the purpose of the Centers for Independent Living are to provide community-based, non-residential supports for individuals with various types of disabilities, their family members, and others. All of our services are designed to prevent out-of-home placements. They're designed to enable individuals to continue to lead self-directed lives in their own homes of their choice in the community. In fact, our mantra, our operating mantra, is don't make people with disabilities dependent on you. A large portion of our social services sector is really designed around that. It perpetuates their existence. And we operate with a slightly different. You've heard a lot of comments this morning about the impact of the cuts from last year and how that will be perpetuated if we see additional cuts this year. And I want to share a little bit of what that means to us as well, but at the same time, I wanted to put a consumer voice on the table this morning as well. In response to the cuts last year to the Health and Human Services bill and the 2.58% cut in the per diem rate for providers and the cut in service hours for individual consumers that's been taking place, the change in the upcoming change in the ADL, the adult or activities of daily living requirement, etc., all of those different things that create accumulated cuts in the budget. In response to that, one of the things that the Metro Center for Independent Living did was we established a hotline, and we encouraged consumers, people who need and use these services, to call the hotline and to anonymously leave some of their comments. And we told them that they didn't have to leave their name. We didn't want them to be any element of intimidation here, but simply to leave their zip code so that we could assure that at least we could get some of these messages to the appropriate legislators so they would know they're hearing from their constituents. So I just want to share a couple of those very briefly, if I may, and then I'll wrap up with a couple of other quick comments and take questions if you like. This is from Kim, and she includes her phone number. It's a 320 area code, but she doesn't include her zip code, so I apologize for that. But she said, "This is Kim. I'm the mother of a son that's 33 years old and mentally retarded with a seizure disorder. Excuse me. His hours were cut from 9.5 hours a day for PCA services to 6.5. I would like to ask the governor just how in the world he thinks that this family can continue to have a quality of life with this kind of a cut, and why he always seems to have to hit people that cannot fight back. If I cannot take care of Michael at home, I would have to place him, and this is not an option for this family since we want to keep our family together. He has medical needs that have not changed. If nothing else, they have gotten worse, and the PCA services that we receive have made a world of difference with this family, and now we have lost 3 of those hours per day. I would just like to know how he justifies this. If there's anything I could do, I would. But I don't know how you can fight it. I just don't know what you can do. I just know it's going to make a huge difference and whether or not we can keep this family together." So a little frustration there from her. From a caller in the zip code 55051. Not sure exactly where that is. I don't have the zip codes memorized for the state of Minnesota. But the caller said, "I have a daughter who is 22 years old and who receives PCA services and has a DD waiver. And her PCA services have been reduced by more than 50%. I've not yet received this in written notice. However, I do plan to appeal." And she was assessed at 9.5 hours a day because she needs those hours to be able to remain home, safe and healthy, and for no other reason. "I'm very concerned about her health and safety. She has very challenging, intense behaviors that interrupt her daily living skills, and she's unable to be unsupervised at all. So I would appreciate if someone does something to reinstate some of these behavior training services or something to compensate for the loss of the PCA services. My understanding is that the behavior component has been removed from the PCA services, but those behaviors did not just disappear overnight, and that made her eligible for those services and PCA in the first place.
I'll skip down here a little bit. I can't go out and get another job because it creates too much stress and chaos. Her behaviors increase and life goes down the tubes. We have been playing this for a long, long time, and I would be happy to share more information. I edited a little bit for time there. And I'll just share one or two other real quickly because I know we need to move along. Thank you, Madam Chair. From zip code 55423, I just think it's ridiculous that people who need services to make their lives complete on a daily basis may be denied, and then they will be required to go into nursing homes or more costly health care in the future. Help people be more independent. There's some editing obviously left out. Don't let them in a situation to have to access emergency room and long-term care facilities when, with the help of a PCA, they could easily stay at home. I know lots of people who are in this situation. And the final one I'll share is, I am an adult with a disability. This is from zip code 56258. I'm an adult with a disability. I currently receive approximately 3 hours a day of PCA services. Without PCA services, I would not be able to be independent. They simply allow me to get out of bed in the morning and get going, and at night I have PCA services also. I live in an apartment building which is accessible, and I'm independent during the day. I'm afraid that without these services, or if they're cut back drastically, I would not be able to live on my own, and I'd be forced to live in some type of group home or nursing home, and that is absolutely something I do not want. So I'm just urging you to consider what PCA cutbacks are meaning to people. Without PCAs, I would not be able to be independent and greatly enjoy my independence and freedom that I have. That is thanks to the PCA services that I do receive. And there are many other calls that I have highlighted here. But, again, I know that we need to move forward, so I won't share the others, but would be happy to make more available. As I mentioned before, and as you are well aware, in the session in 2009, we received cuts of 2.58% in the provider reimbursement rate. With the proposed cuts, additional cuts this session of 2.5%, that would essentially take us down to a $15.44 per hour reimbursement rate for PCA services. Now, some hearing that might think, well, $15.44 an hour, that's not bad. But stop and remember that not all of that is passed directly to the DSP in wages. There are some admin costs that are just there. The Metro Center for Independent Living, our average wage is $11.74 an hour. The top of our wage band is $13.45. Last year, our PCA program alone operated with an admin rate of 5.4%. We're not in this to make money, clearly. Our organizational admin rate for the total organization was 6.7%. I think we operate a very lean and very effective operation. That 2.58% cut reduced our general revenue last year by 9%. We made a decision last year at the 2.58% cut that we were not going to pass that along to the DSP, the direct service person, the individual who provides the PCA services. We made that decision because those individuals are already on the bottom rung of the ladder of the healthcare industry. And we didn't want to. This year, however, we won't be able to absorb that again. By absorbing that last year, it cost us almost $160,000. And we were able to do that within the program. We won't be able to do that again this year. So it will mean somebody who's making an average of $11.74 an hour, they're going to have their salary cut by 2.5%. As you all know, that relates directly to Main Street, the ability to purchase goods and services on Main Street. One thing that I would recommend, if I may, is also an element that was put into place last year, was a 275-hour limit in PCA hours. There is no other profession out there that faces a cap on the number of hours that they can work per month. One of the challenges that has happened is that DHS has interpreted that 275 and have created an exception, creating a 16-hour-a-day limit. There is nothing in the legislation that creates a daily limit. It is a monthly limit, and that has caused, especially for PCAs who work for more than one provider, has caused a tremendous amount of difficulty. And the challenge is that if I turn in a timesheet and I don't get my timesheet in as quickly as the other provider, and on that given day, maybe that person, it's showing 17 hours instead of 16, they don't deny just the 1 hour to that provider. They deny the entire shift. and then it goes into a very lengthy appeal process that can take up to 90 days. Meanwhile, you carry that debt. So I would ask either strict enforcement of the 275 or do away with the 275, which I doubt is likely, or accelerate the, you know, the next step in that plan is to move it up to 310 hours per month. Accelerate that so that people can have the service and the hours that they need. One final comment that I would leave is I believe in the legislation last year, the intent on a lot of these cuts and that was to save around $72 million in the PCA program, something like that, I believe. With the change in the ADL, the Activities of Daily Living, we anticipated, the Department of Human Services themselves anticipated that it would affect about 2,300 people and their eligibility, that they would almost immediately lose services. If just half of those individuals, if 1,100 of those individuals who lose their PCA services or potentially lose their PCA services are forced to seek out-of-home placement in a residential facility or a nursing home, the shift in that cost would be approximately $54,604,000 per year. So essentially wiping out a huge part of the projected savings. And I arrive at that number using average daily costs that are provided by DHS. So I'm getting a little long-winded. I apologize to the audience. I know you're waiting. But I'll be happy to take any questions as well if the committee has any.
Thank you, Representative Bunn.
I'm going to hold off to after to talk to you. Some of your stories conflicted with my understanding of how the PCA changes would work, so I want to follow up with you.
Absolutely.
I'd be
happy to have a conversation.
And also, most of the issue, the last comment you made about the shift, assuming half of them would go to home, I usually expect that to be that type of shift to be reflected in the budget fiscal note. And so we need to talk further about whether it was or was not. Certainly yeah. Things I'm working on this year, that kind of shift is being reflected in our analysis up front. So, and certainly in a number of the columns of the budget, the governor's budget I'm currently working on, shifts like that are being reflected. So I want to further understand that too. Okay. We'll do it offline so we can continue. Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative Bunn, thank you very much. And I'd be happy to have that conversation. I don't know if that shift was, because I'm sure that they, and it may not have been because while the department shared that they expected a percentage of individuals probably would lose their PCA services, I don't know what their intent was, but I doubt that they were projecting that a percentage of those would lose or would have to face out-of-home placement.
Well, we'll want to find
that
out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure. Okay.
Thank you,
Representative Bunn, and thank you for your testimony. Representative Hosh was, I think, our leader kind of on the PCA,
yes.
So we will make sure that he...
And, Madam Chair, I've been working very closely with Representative Hosh through this session. In fact, I just met with him again this week, so,
great.
Yeah. Thank you very much,
Thank you very much for your testimony. Yes.
The ones who need to leave.
Oh, okay. Wait. Who is this one? Oh, Amy Nelson. Okay. Okay. Thank you. The Amy Nelson replacement. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. And we are going to try to wrap it up, I think, by 11:30. Is that right? So I think we just have a couple more. I know I'm sensitive to the fact that you need to get to clinic, so we'll try to get going. Thank you, and welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Davis. I'm the CEO of Accurate Home Care. I'm standing in for Amy Nelson. I'm here representing the Minnesota Home Care Association and our firm, Accurate Home Care, and appreciate the opportunity to come speak about our opposition to the additional 2.5% cut in reimbursement proposed by the governor for the home and community-based services, as we feel that any additional cut is going to be seriously detrimental to the health of the basic industry itself. We've come because we're concerned that the full scope of what we do as an industry is not well understood. Home care is much more than just PCA services. We provide home health aides, nursing, visits from a few times a week, as you've heard, to ICU level quality care 24 hours a day. In the comfort of people's homes, at sometimes we've seen estimates as much as 5 times the savings over types of institutions and hospitals and whatnot. We're dealing with fragile babies on ventilators, adults with genetic conditions, seniors requiring the help of others, and that's just some of the types of the range of services we provide. And many of the stories that you've actually been hearing about that I've been touched by as well. We live with that every day. The expectations are rising for the quality of care, and yet our reimbursements are decreasing, and something's got to give, and it shouldn't be the quality of care. or ignoring the role that that we play as a firm in even acting as the coordinator of care across all the different kinds of organizations that you hear about that support these families. We're concerned that, in fact, if we don't do some things, the viability of the industry itself is in question, and without a healthy business model, we can't support and strive for the professionalism that, in fact, the families are demanding of us. So the home care industry, just to give you an idea, provides jobs for over 100,000 individuals across Minnesota. Deed reports that the top three jobs, regardless of where you are in the state, are nurses, PCAs, and home health aides. One-on-one care is what helps people thrive. I mean, you hear that, you know that. If we continue to cut reimbursements, the wages are going to be forced to cut even further, and this becomes an unattractive field for people to work in and not economically viable for firms like ours to provide the professionalism our clients demand. We believe there are solutions to saving costs, and in fact, a lot of the healthcare reform that's going on is all about, and every day you hear about these savings that are coming on that are consistently showing when you can coordinate care, you're going to do a much better job keeping people out of hospitals, the rehospitalizations, infection controls, the things that are very controllable that we're on the front line with every single day. So we think there's some solutions, but we think it's interesting to note that in the last 5 years, PCA companies, for example, have tripled. And we are, by the way. We do both extended nursing and PCA services. We are, Accurate Home Care is, we believe, the largest in the state of Minnesota today. But PCA companies, for example, have tripled to over 600. The Department of Health has issued Class A home care licenses to over 225 new providers in the past 2 years alone. So there are now over 1,000 home care providers in the state. We've got to stop handing out these provider numbers and licenses like they're candy. I heard of a situation where a PCA service, the official address was actually inside a grocery store, and nobody at DHS knew that. The real challenge, we think that some of the solutions are really not increasing not only the quality of the employees, but really philosophically changing to deal with the quantity of these firms, which would in fact help the structure of the industry and in fact push responsibility to the firms, not as DHS seems to be doing, which is oriented around the symptoms of dealing with the employees themselves. So we think challenging DHS to raise the standards of professionalism of firms like ours is a good thing, and push that responsibility, push the accountability to the firms is actually going to have a lot of positive impact and a leveraged impact on the kinds of stories you hear about PCAs or nurses or situations that we all work and strive very hard to avoid. We believe that it would also be very positive, and you'd have cost savings if you implemented quality measures for non-Medicare providers that we can report against, such as the outcomes of rehospitalizations and the like. We're not afraid of transparency. We love it. We strive for it every day in the work we do. We believe a limit on new providers should be put in place until we have the ones that we have under control. And in fact, you know, it's pretty well known that DHS really doesn't understand the full scope of the firms that they've licensed. So lastly, for example, I think that you could argue that the home care industry has in some cases been considered a bit of a stepchild to the industry in nursing and the medical field. But, you know, I'll ask you, when was the last time a doctor made a house call? We're in the homes every day. It's amazing the things that you learn when you're in somebody's home, not in a negative way, but in a positive way to help in a more holistic sense, helping the family to heal, not treat the medical situation. And that's what we've done by the way we operate, and it's true for a lot of our colleagues. So we think that, in fact, the fraud that's been a concern for a lot of people would be substantially reduced if there was more accountability put on those agencies who employ the workers. And, in fact, passing the rate cuts is only treating a symptom that's going to hurt those caregivers who are the quality providers. In other words, let's get rid of the bad, and we'll, in fact, do a great deal to actually improve the overall economics and achieve the savings that the governor is looking for. So it's our sense that home care is in demand. We all know that. It's the future in some respects of a lot of different aspects of the reform that's going on. We know it's cost effective. It's where people want to be, and in fact supports a health care reform if it's a sustainable business and a respected line of work. Cutting wages is only going to make it more difficult for us to try to attract and employ and train those workers that provide the same level of care and professionalism that we aspire to as a business. So what we ask you to ask for your support is to take those steps that help us increase the professionalism, not by cutting rates, but addressing structural weaknesses in the professionalism of the industry. And a healthy home care industry keeps people like the ones you've been hearing about and I've been listening to, out of expensive institutional settings. We keep people from rehospitalization. We improve the coordination of care across the continuum of medical care, and we would appreciate your support in doing that. A rate cut, in effect, is taking us in the wrong direction. Thank you very much. Could I answer any questions for you?
Thank you very much for your testimony, Representative Bond. Do you have any comments?
Just a comment. I think we met in early February for the first time, and I thank you for being here, but I just want to say you have several very specific ideas, and I look forward to working with you and some good news on those ideas. So I think there's some good material to go with forward with, so thank you.
Thank you.
I was going to echo that as well. Thank you very much.
Well, we look forward to helping.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Scott Lights. Is that okay? Are you still okay? Okay, thank you, your time. Welcome to the committee, and I think this is the first time I've had the opportunity to see you in committee in your new, or maybe it's a second, in your new capacity.
Well, so. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. My name is Scott Lights, and I'm the Public Policy Director at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota. Thank you for your time this morning. I want to start by saying that we are aware of the budgetary challenges that the state faces, but I do want to highlight for the committee how the administration's 2010 supplemental budget will disproportionately impact on children's. The cuts proposed by the administration have a direct and immediate impact on our ability to deliver the best quality of care to patients and families. As the cuts accumulate, as they have over the course of the last several years, they also have a longer-term impact as we are forced to make difficult choices about where to cut programs that are vital to the health and healing of kids. The reimbursement rates we've faced over this decade are cumulative. Delays in rebasing of rates is cumulative. Reductions in supplemental DSH payments is cumulative. And reductions in MRC add to this. Ultimately, this presents lost opportunities over time for us to invest in the health of children in Minnesota. Let me take just a moment to highlight the impact of the governor's latest proposals on Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota. As you know, Children's serves kids from every county in the state. We also serve a highly diverse population of children. We translate in over 40 languages and provided over 50,000 translator encounters last year. We also serve a highly complex and sick population. Half of our beds are critical care beds. Simply put, we serve many of the sickest children from all over the state of Minnesota. We serve more children covered under the medical assistance program and prepaid medical assistance than any other provider in the state. Medical assistance is children's single largest source of income and revenue. It accounted for over 40% of our revenue in 2009, and actually in January of this year, that figure had risen to around 43% of our revenue. So obviously, medical assistance is a big deal for Children's of Minnesota. In comparison, an acute care hospital that serves adults might average between 5 and 10% Medicaid, just as a comparison point. For calendar year 2010, just getting to some of the specifics in the governor's budget, our supplemental disproportionate share payments were expected to total about $7 million. These payments were intended for providers who serve high percentages of Medicaid beneficiaries. The governor's proposal eliminates that funding entirely. As a result of the cumulative Medicaid reductions that have occurred over the past several years, children's costs, again, this isn't charges, this is our actual costs, our excess of Medicaid payments have now escalated to around $43 million. So that's costs in excess of payment. Under the governor's budget, our costs, again, not charges, are projected to exceed Medicaid payments by almost $47 million in 2010. And overall, the governor's proposal would impact Children's by an additional $27 million over the next 3 years, and that would be in addition to the figures that I just mentioned. Because of the role we play in serving Minnesota's low-income children, most of whom are on medical assistance, budget decisions related to Medicaid disproportionately impact Children's to a greater degree than nearly any other hospital in the state. Whether we're talking about DSH payments, rebasing of rates, MRC, or reimbursement rates, the administration's proposal and the decisions made on each of these elements will hit children's hospitals and clinics of Minnesota very hard. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony, members. Representative Legley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does Children's get any out-of-state business?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, we do. We draw from the five-state area. We draw from a number of states, but primarily the work that we do largely is Minnesota, but we do draw from Wisconsin and the Dakotas as well as Iowa.
And then, Madam Chair, thank you. I'm sorry if you said that and I missed it because I came in during your testimony, but are those also MA patients or are those who's being drawn from those other states? You're bringing in also private pay?
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, it is a mix. It is some Medicaid patients from other states. Because we are a regional referral center for some highly complex patients, we draw kids from every stripe of life. So we do get some Medicaid patients as well as private pay and others.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I'm not that familiar with Children's, actually. So I'm glad to have the opportunity to find out a little more about it. But is Children's required? I mean, in terms of taking MA patients from other states, I assume that, you know, the figures you've given us, that's part of it. Does Children's have any? Option in that? Is the reimbursement the same from the MA patients from other states? Do those patients have other options? Can you address that a little bit?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, we do, as I mentioned, serve sort of as a regional referral center for kids, and we're actually very proud of the fact that we do serve kids regardless of their ability to pay, and we will accept payment. You know, we certainly accept the reimbursement rates that other states pay us. Minnesota, you know, as every state's been struggling with Medicaid as an issue because of state budgets and how they've been, Minnesota traditionally has actually had better, in some sense, reimbursement rates. That's becoming less and less the case, obviously, as you've had to make difficult decisions over the course of the past several years. Most of our business still is Minnesota business. When we do draw children from other states, we do accept them without, regardless of their ability to pay in whatever program they happen to be on, and simply accept that payment, whether it comes from the Medicaid program or private insurers or out-of-pocket or charity care, depending on the situation of the child. In terms of the Medicaid payment that we would receive, for example, from a child from Wisconsin or the Dakotas, whatever the reimbursement rate that operates under those states' programs would be the reimbursement rate we would receive for providing those services.
Just one little follow-up. Is that something that part of the – do we have any control over that? I mean, you know, do we have any way of getting better reimbursement from those states? You know, do we have agreements with those states or do we have no control of that?
Mr. Vice, sorry.
Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, under today's environment, we would enter into contracts with the Medicaid programs in those states. We have never, to my knowledge, as a state, for example, worked with the neighboring states to sort of think about reciprocity agreements as it relates to Medicaid rates. Certainly it's something that could be explored. To my knowledge, we haven't done, as a state, haven't really done that. And so that's kind of how it, to my understanding, works in today's environment.
Okay. Thank you. Great.
Thank you. Absolutely. I am going to, and I'm going to apologize to Mr. Brand. I think I'm going to have Dr. Maynard speak, if that's okay. Okay. Oh, thank you. Because I don't want either one of you to have to feel like you're rushed in your testimony, and I know he has to do that. So thank you very much for that, and I apologize for that. Thank you, and welcome to the committee, and thank you for your patience.
Madam Chair and committee, thank you for having us here today. I am one of those doctors who do house calls. My name is Roy Maynard. I'm here to represent a relatively small but precious population of medically fragile and technology-dependent children that we take care of in the home environment, and that's where my visits have been, to go and visit these kids with their trachs and ventilators at home so the parents don't have to bring them into the home.
Minnesota has a fabulous reputation for providing home care for technology-dependent children, and nationally is probably one of the best. I'm representing Pediatric Home Services, too, a sophisticated medical equipment company that provides the ventilators and home technology to keep these kids in the home and out of the hospital. These kids can be taken care of at home in the range of up to $700 a day. If these kids end up back in the hospital, room charges alone can be up to $5,800 a day. So as you can imagine, it's very cost-effective to keep these kids at home in a safe and nurturing environment with their families where they belong. Proposed budget cuts would have a significant impact on our technology-bound kids. Those budget cuts could end up being profound enough to put these kids back into the hospital for them to receive their care. Obviously, that's going to increase a lot of health care costs in the long run. In addition, it's going to delay health care access for regular children out there with acute problems when those pediatric beds that are very precious in this community are tied up with chronic kids that could be safely managed in the home environment. And down the road, if these children can't be provided for at home, those providers who take care of these kids at home, ultimately their businesses will suffer. Increase in unemployment as the, you know, people who provide services for those kids are laid off from their jobs too. So I think it's very important to realize that these technology-dependent kids can be managed in a very safe, cost-effective fashion at home, like we've been doing for the past 20 years, where my role has been as a neonatologist and lung doctor at the Children's Hospital, and have taken care of a lot of these kids in hospital and out of the hospital. And they just thrive at home, and it can be done very safely and very cost-effective. And our concern is that these budget cuts may have an impact upon our capacity to continue to deliver safe care for these kids at home.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
My name is Susan Wingert. I'm the CEO of Pediatric Home Service. I will just briefly inform you of some of the business aspects of this. Obviously, safe patient care in the home is something that Dr. Maynard can attest to and has seen over the last 20 years. However, I think from a business perspective, you all need to understand that this is not businesses that can be run without very highly professional, very highly trained, and unfortunately then, rather highly paid folks. Right now, in my business, I have openings for three positions: an administrative assistant, a medical billing specialist, and a RN. I am not filling those positions today. I cannot fill those positions. The 1.5% cut in the unallotment, on top of the 3% cut we got last year, not only required me to stay flat in my increases for my employees, but it also required me to not bring on the kinds of people that you need to have employed. If the governor's request goes through and that 1.5 stays there and additional cuts are happening, what will happen is approximately 35% of our patient population resides outside of the 11-county metro area. I will have to reduce access. 35% of the children, we have approximately now 175 to 200 ventilator patients alone. We cover or carry about 3,500 patients on our entire service. Of those 170 to 200 respirator patients, you're going to see 35% of them have to come someplace else. As Dr. Maynard says, that's the hospital. That's going to not only create less jobs, but I'm going to have to lay people off. Because as a business, as you all know, the bank says, you know, make the payments and have a profit, and if you don't, you're without any support financially. So Dr. Maynard and I request, please, please, that the committee do not continue that 1.5% decrease. We ask you to look very carefully and in your hearts to take care of the children who can least defend themselves. This is Tana. Tana is a perfectly lovely, charming young girl who goes to school, who is a ventilator-dependent child, who, may I point out, skis, goes to Mexico, and goes to her cabin. These are the kids we're talking about. They will contribute. They will help the state. You can't let them down now.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And just a comment or two questions. Dr. Maynard, did you do your residency at the University of Minnesota?
Yes, I did.
I think I was there the same time you were.
I did my residency and both of my fellowships there. And in between that time, I was an Indian Health Service physician for 3 years in South Dakota with the Sioux Indians.
Yes, I was. It was maybe state. I can't even remember what station it was. Station 40. It was the Children's Intensive Care Unit. And you worked maybe in the NICU.
Yeah,
or?
Back then.
Yep, I remember you. That's neat. And thank you for your testimony. I think one of the things your testimony points out is really how our health care is changing. And I think we, as a body, sometimes the policies don't, you know, it takes a while to keep up with it and recognize the change. And I'm wondering if with the advances, it's over, you mentioned 20 years, you know, been doing this for over 20 years, but what is the trend line that you see for, you know, what we're doing today and where that's going to go?
Make no mistake about it. The number of technology-dependent children coming out of the children's hospitals in the nation is increasing. And you probably recently saw this movie with Harrison Ford, Extraordinary Measures. When I was an intern and a resident, Pompe's disease was a lethal disease, end of story. There's now a form of enzyme replacement therapy that's well documented in the movie. And in fact, PHS provides service for two of those children who are at-home patients, one who's still on a ventilator, who receive home IV enzyme replacement outside the hospital setting at a fraction of the cost. What are we doing? They have an improved quality and quantity of life. And as more technologies like that develop, the number of technology-dependent children is increasing. PHS has been growing every year because there's more and more kids coming out of the hospital needing more and more services.
Thank you. Comments or questions, members? Representative Vaughn.
I'm really a policy person and not much of a political person at my core, but I just want to say something in terms of this overall challenge we're facing. You know, the comments we've heard from our governor and others in the last, well, I won't say for a period of time, certainly over the summer, comments at press conferences about what we really have to go after is our burgeoning health and human services budget, and that we are out of line with all the other states or surrounding states or one of the highest in the country per enrollee. Much of that is a true statement. I looked at the underlying data, and most all of it, the difference with other states, depending on what data you look at, is driven by our disability categories. Our per enrollee disability categories is higher than any other state, or at least 10% higher than any other state in the 11 state region. As we've heard in several of the testimony today, we're nationally known and have incredible reputations in a number of these areas because of the quality of the work we've developed in this area over time, and really, good service levels, innovative programs, really do a wonderful job, and it's evolved on a bipartisan basis to support for all this. And so when we talk about taking nine errands to government, we are talking about taking an iron to this portion of our budget, the health and human service budget has been directly linked to that. And I just would say that not that we won't have to do these major changes and cuts, because as I said earlier in the testimony, my comments that, we won't be able to raise revenues. There's no way to maintain all of this in any way. I just hope that you all and your I wish the room was, I just said this earlier in the day. we can't be the sole messengers of this. We need you all writing viewpoints to our major papers. We need you all working in our communities across the state saying, this is a values choice. Minnesota historically made the values choice to make the investment in this area to support people at this level. And it is true we can't remain out of line with all our states or the nation or the global economy with revenues and those kind of things. We have to, attend to that being competitive. Absolutely, I'm an economist. But at the same time, these are really tough values choices. And we need, and it's going to get really intense really fast here in the next year, that all of you, not just through your professional capacities that you, in the roles you work in advocating, but you, your neighbors, your churches, your have a discussion about the future of our state. I can't ask you that emphatically, not just in your professional roles, every aspect of your lives, to reach out and do that and to educate people about what government actually is. This is what government is. It's private duty nursing, $100 million in our budget. Okay, and we need to know that's where our taxpayer dollars are going. And much of it driven by aging, and as I mentioned earlier, but also much of it driven by technology. We're keeping children alive who 20, 30 years ago would not have lived to the age of 18. We're keeping adults like Christopher Reeve with spinal injuries alive that would never have lived, you know, previously, that require ventilators and around the care nursing. Between our technology and our values, we've evolved that. And that's where our taxpayers' dollars are going, and that in our school kids and our higher education. And so we need to help you all to help us message what these choices really mean, and that we as a community and a state make these tough choices within our values, but at least have accurate information and the faces of these folks in front of us when we're having that discussion. So thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to see you again. And thank you. And finally, welcome. Thank you for your patience.
Yeah, welcome. Sure.
Mr. Brand, thank you. And we will listen very attentively, I promise.
Sure. Am I the last one, really?
I think you are, unless there are other people.
That takes me to send in my email earlier. No, I'm glad to be here. My name's Ron Brand, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And before I sort of launch into my talk here, I just wanted to acknowledge the incredible challenge that this your division here and the legislature and all of us face at this point. It's the most challenging. I've been doing this job now for almost 20 years, and this is the most challenging, I think, moral and budgetary situation I've experienced. I'm in awe of your dedication and your hard work. And the way you've approached it. I work for a statewide group, MacMap, that's how you say it in it's short, is a statewide group of safety net providers that come out of a tradition that started long ago in the 60s with in the Kennedy administration, when they thought, geez, we had 21,000 people in Minnesota that were in state hospitals at the time, and the big vision was, how do we help move people out of hospitals and develop community alternatives to give people a better life. And so we come out of that tradition, and I represent the community mental health centers, which are like community health centers at community clinics. We provide services without regard to people's ability to pay, so it's a sliding fee schedule. And what's interesting is that we provide a combination of services. We employ collectively around the state about 80 psychiatrists, about the same number of advanced practice nurses. We have several hundred mental health professionals, licensed psychologists, clinical social workers, a couple thousand other direct care staff that are doing home-based services or doing day treatment or all the acronyms that you'll hear. But they work together in a team to try to, because that's what you learn to do. You learn, if you're going to have people out of a hospital, even if it's for a short period of time, you end up having the same kind of intensity and frequency of services by a team that you would have in a hospital, even if it's only a short period of time. And that, so you hear things about day treatment or supported housing, school link services, assertive community treatment, family support services, outpatient therapy, crisis services, children's, you know, therapeutic supports and services, ARMS, the adult rehabilitative services. About two-thirds of our members are also licensed as chemical dependency treatment providers, and many of them provide waiver services. A few of them manage an inpatient facility, and some of our home health agencies and do other services like that. But what the real deal here is that the budget really is all about these individuals. And last year our members served about 125,000 people. And a substantial majority of those services are funded by public sources, a combination of things. So it's important for me to express to you that
our members provide this combination of services, and that's the best practices, the evidence-based practices that work over and over again for this population, are a coordinated mix of this therapy, rehabilitative services, social supports, and medications, and combined in a conscious, planned way. And so our members are all about the business of coordinating and combining a mix of services, and that's their strength. That is their strength, because they're all staff, they're all employees. Even if they're under contract, they're contract employees. That's their strength. But it also makes them terribly vulnerable in this budget. And so each of those services that I mentioned are funded by a mix of public and private sources. Maybe 75% of the funding might come from public sources. But when you start looking at the line items on this, in the overall governor's proposal, it's taken together, the cumulative cuts have a huge impact on the clients that we serve and on the combinations of services that we try to pull together. And the cumulative effect is really what I wanted to talk about, and that's what I'm here to try to call your attention to. So I wrote this line, and I think it's probably my best one, but the budget is really a sorry litany of sad news for the for our community mental health providers and their clients. Some of the cuts that that we see aren't necessarily in health and human services, but they have an impact on our members and will have an impact on our ability to serve these folks in a very cost-effective way. It's amazing because our member organizations are now core providers for Medica and Blue Cross Blue Shield for their private commercial population, because they see the effectiveness of our ability to step down people to other kinds of care and to provide services in a very efficient way. But look, let's see, I'm going to go through the sorry litany really quickly, but cuts to county program aid. It's not your jurisdiction, but there's $125 million of cuts in county program aid. Those end up, maybe 10% on average that goes to fund mental health services. And what does it do? Well, it covers some of the non-reimbursable services that people need that you can't bill for. It covers some of the, occasionally we'll have medications that we have on hand that we give people to tide them over. It covers some of the services for uninsured, those initial contacts of doing diagnosis. It might cover the care coordination and consultation. And it covers the non-federal share of some of our services for case management and care coordination. Adult mental health grants are cut almost three and a half million. I'm just going to go through these quickly. Children's and adults, some specialized service grants are cut by about almost $500,000. There's crisis services funding that, with working with police and things that what is cut and eliminated. The children's and community services grant about is cut by $22.5 million. And around 25% of that goes to mental health services, kind of split half and half by adults and children. There's children mental health grants that are cut by $1.2 million. There's adult day treatment programs, which is direct payment for providers. The number of allowable hours goes from 115 to 60, saving $500,000. But that really is only a list of providers that do that. It's on the top half of this page. It's a very short list of providers. And there's other ways we could approach that thing, and I have ideas about that. The Chemical Dependency Fund is cut by 5%. At the same time, we're cutting state-operated services by about $7.5 million. So that's the state safety net providers. Housing, some special housing plus services programs are being eliminated. We have caddy waiver slots cut by a third. Third new ones per month, and about 40% of the people on that have mental illness. You see how these accumulate. We have inpatient hospital cut. We have eligibilities cut. In the allotments, there was about $9 million of adult mental health services that are cut this year for in a grant program that is eliminated. And there's a cut in the payments that psychiatrists would receive in the cut to specialist physicians, and that's a very big hit because that's a big part of what our we lose money on psychiatry, but it's so much important it's so important as part of our team. But because psychiatrists provide office visits and same as any other specialists or consultations, they're cut by another percent and a half. So it's really painful cuts, and the saddest thing for me is that I have been working hard to have these providers be very accountable, to be very efficient and productive, to have partnerships with local hospitals and with health plans, and to be able to care for people with pretty complex things. People who get involved with our services seldom go to the hospital. You know, new patients end up there, but very seldom do they go to the hospital. So there's a million little problems we have. So when we start talking about GAMC redesign, we have 16,500 people on GAMC who we serve that are would be affected by this. The proposals in front of you, you know, cut the outpatient services, making it, you know, that's like cutting off one of our legs, you know, when we're trying to run to catch up with these people. But it's, well, we're part of the solution, not part of the problem. I mean, we are definitely the members of my association are definitely part of the safety net, and we're part of the solution. Because people with mental illness, if you get to them early and you provide the right combination of services, they get better. Recovery is possible. People have tremendous resilience, and the majority of people are not necessarily going to be that way for the rest of their life. Many, many people become functional, working people. My friend Janet, was taking off hours and hours from work, and her job was threatened. They developed a really great program for her daughters who had serious emotional disturbance, and the whole idea was we wanted to save her as an employee for 3M. And by creating the right program here, 3M flexed their benefits in order to make it possible for us to develop this alternative package of services for a period of time, because they didn't want Janet to lose her job because they needed her on that team. You know, we do things like that. So I worry about our ability to be able to do the job that is in front of us with the many people that are falling into the safety net, the new core. And I'm deeply concerned for the viability of some of our member centers and some of their key programs. And I'm worried for some of the jobs of the 3,000 or so people who we employ. I think about it in the evenings, you know, and I know enough, having done this job, to see how the accumulation of the various cuts as they combine would have a very, very harmful effect. And so I'm, you know, what do I want from all that? I guess I would say that I want to keep selling the idea that mental health stuff, especially community mental health, coordinated mental health, is an investment that actually has a return. And you'll see that in the GAMC bill that's moving along here, that of the things in there, and the only thing that actually has a savings is the mental health proposal. Okay, and we do of those 16,500 people I mentioned on GAMC, the spending for community mental health, GAMC, the spending for community mental health on them, this is now goes to 08 data, was only about $15.5 million. So I mean, we're not, you know, the people that we employ who are mental health practitioners are making less than teachers make. Certainly psychiatrists get paid the market rates, but I'm not talking, we're not about lining everyone's salaried, etc. And the combinations, the reason I talk about the combinations of services as our strength is because that's what's effective, but it makes us vulnerable, because one portion of a program that loses money then affects our whole. And it's the combinations that really have the high impact. So that's my story. I appreciate having an opportunity to talk with you about that.
Thank you.
And I'd be glad to be a resource to you as we move through the session in any way possible.
Thank you for your testimony. And I have a quick question. You have a question too?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, first of all, thank you for that testimony. And it is sad. And I think all of us are up at nights. I know I didn't used to grind my teeth, but I do now, and I've cracked several because of it. It's very disturbing. I am a nurse practitioner, and I remember the cuts in 2003. That's one of the big reasons I ended up running for office, because I had patients who were being taken care of.
Especially with children.
Yes, and saw really the lives unravel before my eyes, and never dreamed that I'd be in this situation. I'm wondering if you can compare that time and the kind of the, how those cuts impacted what you do and how you see the comparison to where we're headed now. And obviously, it's worse, but there were any lessons
there were
to be learned?
There were some reforms that took place around that same time in the mental health system or shortly thereafter that were helpful in terms of changing what private insurance would cover and how Medicaid reimbursements for professional services work. So this is actually worse because there's things that are cumulative. The children's area, the children's mental health area, the grant funding that helps support some of the core services is actually, you know, had a huge cut in 03, and now again it's another 4%. So cumulative, it's probably that area is down, I would say, 60% since it was from the point where it was in maybe 02. And so given what we have now, it's huge. And in part what happens is we get caught, because a lot of funding runs through the counties, we get caught in this, the maintenance of effort and county mandates, and counties lose money, and so instead of contracting for certain services, they use it to backfill some of their staff positions and things like that. And so where so many things have been cut lean now, that the chances now of those dollars, those contracts and those direct services, you know, where it's very likely that they'll be used, some of the money will be used to backfill county staff. It's worse. What's coming is worse.
Yeah. And if you have ideas as far as, like you said, you get caught, you know, boy, we'd sure love to,
we
you know,
get
with
caught
the means of effort.
It's really hard because in a way we get the, you know, the, you know, the water goes into the pipes and it goes around and round and all these joints and, you know, and it comes out here and you're trying to, you know, how much of it's really coming out. So we, you know, any provider appreciates direct payments.
Sure,
you know,
absolutely.
The, you know, it's cut down on the amount of plumbing, you know, between the water going into the faucet and what comes out. We have some, I would love to work with you on this. And
yeah, that'd be great.
There's in Minnesota, when we first designed some of the intensive rehabilitative services that we do for children and adults, it was years ago, and we know more now about what works, and we also have had changes in what CMS at the federal level expect from community providers. There have been audits, there's rigorous efforts to try to, you know, maintain medical necessity, and they've changed all the coding available. There's all sorts of new HCPCS codes that have come out that that weren't available when we first started. So here's the deal, is that a lot of the grant funds and county funds and our United Way funds and other things end up being used in some ways to cross-subsidize gaps in how we've designed our Medicaid-funded paid services. So some of the care coordination, some of the consultation between providers is not reimbursed. Some of the assessments that we do to determine what a plan of care would be and what a kid's functioning and the assessment associated with that is paid as a diagnostic assessment, about $100. When a public health nurse does assessments for the purposes of CADI waivers or PCA, home health, things like that, that's a whole, you know, it's very similar to what we would do, but it's paid about $360. You know, and they're really, so what, because we don't, they haven't defined that service, you know, in to really capture the actual activities that are going on, we end up cross-subsidizing that activity, that service, through other sources. So the point is that I think there could be some opportunities to administratively make some changes in the coverage that is there. I don't even know if a fiscal note would be necessary, to be honest with you, because there's underspending, because providers have had a, you can't bill an assessment service as though you're doing a therapy or rehab service.
Right.
It's fraud. But back when we first started this program, they assumed that we could do that.
Oh,
you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
But now we can't. Yeah. And so there have been just sort of changes in the climate and changes in the expectations around coding, which means the reason this is so important is it means that our staff, salaried staff, when they go out and see somebody, they have to achieve a certain number of billable hours in order for
it's
it to be
for
successful.
Production.
In order to, for it to work. I mean, they have, and if they're doing client care, but it's not billable,
that's right.
That means they basically, we have to subsidize that with something else, which puts us into a huge deficit. So there are things we could do that could leverage additional federal financial participation by refinancing and redefining some of the services more precisely.
Well, I'd be happy to continue that conversation with you offline.
And I know we're done.
That's, well, Representative Liebling had a question, so I wanted to get to her.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you very much. And, yeah, I'd love to, you know, if you can give us some of those specific things.
It's payment reform, really.
It's payment reform in order to support the best practices.
Absolutely.
That
and you have, if you're keeping people out of the hospital, it's based on the outcome, which is great. So I'm sorry to interrupt.
I've researched it. I've looked at 25 different state plans to understand these things.
Yeah, that's great. This is stuff that, you know, we're generalists. We have really, it's hard to get our arms around this kind of stuff. But the question I wanted to ask you, just kind of to, you know, use you as a resource a little bit, is, you know, I also sit on the Public Safety Finance Committee.
Yes, I remember. Yeah.
And one of the things, you know, is, of course, that we have an awful lot of people in our criminal justice system who really have mental illness.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that's an area that's almost sacrosanct. We can't cut public safety. Well, actually, we are going to cut public safety. But, you know, that gets, you know, kind of held just close, pretty close to harmless.
Right.
But it just always...
I think the governor's budget did hold it harmless, yes.
You know, certainly the Department of Correction... Well, there are cuts proposed. But, you know, it's not anywhere near the proposed cuts in this area.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just...
Yes.
Can't help but think there has to be a better way and a more cost-effective way. And I just wonder if you've given any thought to those issues.
Sure, lots. We have had some, as you probably know, there have been some the development of mobile crisis teams and other crisis services that have been were funded by the legislature a couple years ago. Those are, you know, have been developing and they're up and running now, and they have a huge impact on the number of placements in both diversions from ER and jail placements. They also, because of they coordinate well with police, and in the Brainerd area, there would be one that I would you know, commend to you to look at, but there's others. And I'm sure you've heard from NAMI that talking about those things, that our members often are the ones who provide those services. Let's see. We have some programs that are really done by local, on the local dollars that are, and there was a new grant that we received to do some in-jail assessments, consultation services that I think we could build on that are aimed at trying to help people who are in jail, and they probably have, I'm not saying they haven't committed a crime, but if they have a mental illness, if you can use that time to connect them with, have a good screening and assessment and get them started with possibility of getting some services. It's a crisis in their lives, and it's often a good time to make that happen. There are diversions. There are, you know, there are mental health courts that are being done in the Twin Cities, but not necessarily universally around the state. There are a number of things that could be done, but the point is that cuts in, at least with mental health related stuff, cuts in this budget have an impact on someone else's budget.
Right.
And you'll see that in the education area, and you see that in the public safety in the local, and it's the county jails more than the prisons. Actually.
Well, that's so often the case in the things that we do that, you know, where people just are shoving something off to another budget. But
so many of the things that we need to have happen become discussions between committee chairs.
Yes, yes. But I was even thinking, and maybe this, we can end now, but I just to sort of throw this out, you know, the... All the things, of course, that you're talking about are also slated to be cut.
Yes.
But, you know, the thing that doesn't really get cut is the prison business itself.
Yes.
And so I think in order, if we're really going to save money, we have to take people that we're right now spending lots of money on. I mean, the prevention is great, but that's not in this budget, you know?
That's right.
The savings aren't always in this budget.
If we spend, they might save.
Yeah. Right, exactly. Washington State was an example for what they did.
Right, but we need to, you know, see if there's a way that we can, you know, take some of the people on whom we're spending $30,000 and more to incarcerate them. and move them into some of these other.
Right. Yeah. If we could shorten things. Their time. One, the research on this is, in general, Minnesota has a higher percentage of people in prison now, not jails, prison, than most states do, who have people with mental illness. That's also because we have community corrections, and there's a number of reasons why that exists. But when we've looked at that, one of the reasons is that people often with serious mental illness, or often mental illness and chemical dependency, what happens is they just do dumb things when they're on supervised release. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're in the Super America and they grab a bag of peanuts, you know, and now they're in trouble. Or they'll do something, you know, it's really more of a symptom of their mental illness or their bad judgment, if you will, than it is violence. Now, there are people who are violent. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to excuse it, but oftentimes it's just people who are in a, they're just caught up in their mental illness and they get themselves in trouble, you know. So that could be prevented. So they go back. Our readmissions or recidivism for people with mental illness is very high, is the point I'm making. That's where we can intervene.
Thank you. Well, thank you. That was excellent. And next meeting is
Tuesday.
I guess it'll be posted. So, and unless there's further testimony, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Can you use your office for a minute or no?
Yeah. Yeah, you want to come talk?
Yeah, I do. Sure.